こんにちは。
こんにちは。
今日は特別編ということで、脚本家の近藤司さんに来てもらっています。イエイ。
ようこそ。
どうも、はじめまして、近藤です。
マミと司さんはなんかあれですよね、ツイッターとかで話をしてきていて、でもこうやってちゃんと顔を見て、まあ、リモートですけど顔を見て音声で喋るのは初めてですね。
初めてです。よろしくお願いします。
お願いします。軽く自己紹介していただいてもいいですか。
はい、トロントとニューヨークを中心に脚本家とあと役者としても活動している近藤司と言います。何か最近はドラマとかあとアニメの脚本を書いたり、してます。
報道バズっていう番組、アマゾンプライムにありますよね。
はい。
あれをちょっと見てみてっていう感じで半年前ぐらいにリンクを送ってもらって、私がそれを見て感想を司さんに実況してたんだけどすごい面白かったです。
ありがとうございます。すごくさっきちょうどマイケルとマミに言ってたんですけど、バイリンガルニュースは、私がアメリカに渡った直後ってもないか、まあ、バイリンガルニュースが始まった直後ぐらいからずっと友達の紹介で聞いてて、すごくファンだったので出れて嬉しいです。あ、関係ないこれ話そう、報道バズの話をしてたんですよ。
嬉しい。
あ、そう、なんでかっていうと、その、バイリンガルなんですよ。その報道バズっていうドラマもニューヨークで撮影してて、主人公は日本人たちなので、セリフは日本語も英語も半分半分ぐらいになっていて、そういう接点もありました。
うん、なんかメディア、あらすじをちょっとネタバレしない感じでちょっと教えてもらってもいいですか、見てない人のために。
はい。日本の大手テレビ局で働いていた女子アナが、本当は報道をやりたいんだけどもバラエティの仕事ばっかりをやらされていて、それに、それをそのために辞めてニューヨークの、まあ、ニュースアプリ、ニュースウェブサイトで働くために渡米して、ジャーナリストとして働き始めるんだけども、まあ、ひょんなことから、日本のメディアの、まあ、問題点とかタブーを、扱うようになって、それと同時にオンラインで、ハラスメントを受けるようになって、どんどんと自分自身が事件に巻き込まれていくっていう話です。
そう、その主人公が和田さんっていうね、女性なんだけど、すごいこう、もうなんだろう、めっちゃ応援しちゃう感じのなんだろう、キャラクターで、普通の感覚、私にとっての普通の感覚で言うと、当たり前のことを話してるんだけど、日本のそのテレビ業界とかエンタメ業界の普通で言うと、あ、これはこの報道バズっていうドラマは民放の普通のテレビ局では放送できないなっていう感じですよね。
そうですね。ネタバレ、私は別に知って、maybe we can go into details later, but for now maybe、for viewers who haven't watched 報道バズ、日本のメディア業界の面白いのって、まあ、バイリンガルニュースでもよくお二人が話されてると思うんですけど、みんなが実はもう当然のように知ってることなんだけど、テレビとか新聞の上では、話さないことになっているみたいな、トピックとかルールが、まあ、たくさんあって、報道バズで扱ってるような、報道バズ上では、まあ、クォートンクォートタブーっていうようなものが出てくるんですけど、多分あれがタブーだというか、あの事実を知って驚く人って業界の外にも別にいないというか、あ、そうだよね、芸能事務所とテレビでつながってるよねとか、こういうことはニュースでは扱えないよねとか、まあ、テレビってどうせお金もらってるんでしょみたいなことって、日本でテレビ新聞を見て生活してる人は誰も驚かないと思うんですけど、でもそれをドラマの中で、話題として扱うっていうこと自体が珍しいかなと思いますね。
うん。
What would you say the genre of the show is?
I think at the core it's a drama, maybe thriller, but we did try to put we didn't want to make it like too serious, like through and through. Mm-hmm. So there are moments of comedy, like humor. Mm. So yeah, そんなに重い、なんかその日本でよくある、社会派ドラマとか社会派映画って聞いたら、すごくそのトピックについて知識を持ったり、関心がないと見れないと、思ってしまう人もいるかもしれないんですけど、そういうもんでも結構軽いジョークとかもいっぱい入っていて、見やすいんじゃないかなと思ってます。
うん、I actually watched the whole show last night.
Oh, you did?
With my girlfriend. Yeah, I enjoyed it quite a lot. I thought it was very interesting. And I asked that question because I had one sense of the genre early on, and it kind of evolved as the story progressed. And so it seems like a tricky question, like what genre does this really fit
into?
Yeah,
it's hard to summarize the story in one sense. I think it is a... as a creator, I really enjoyed having that liberty or bandwidth of like whatever ideas I had, I was able to put in the story. But I can say it's some people might, if you are a professional producer, you might call it a failure of like establishing yourself as something that's easily marketable, if you know mm-hmm. what I mean. But that's also the joy of creating something, you know, indie. Right. So yeah, we're having a hard time marketing this product, but please watch.
Yeah, please
how are
watch.
You? How are you going about marketing it, and how do you think about that? Like, what do you think people would find most appealing about the show?
I still feel like we're not reaching the wide audience that this it takes a big audience for you, as a creator, for you to really start receiving criticisms, because mm-hmm. obviously whatever you create, it spreads from you or your friends and family, you know, someone who's already interested in the topic, or mm-hmm. someone who's, you know, compatible with the style or whatever the reason is. So in the beginning, and this is not only Hodo Buzz, you know, Hodo Buzz touches upon a lot of controversial topics, but that's not the main reason. Whatever I do, in the beginning, I tend to get a lot of really positive feedback, like mm-hmm. encouragement and support for my just as my personal journey, right? Because these are people that support me in general. So Hodo Buzz, I don't think we've reached a point where, you know, people like trash talking or even like objective criticisms without feeling the need to like support it. So I guess to answer your question, I think we're marketing it poorly. we have to try hard. Yeah.
How much do the values of this fantasy company, like how much do those values mean to you personally? Is that something that you think about a lot, like these conflicts in sort of corporate situations or with the media or censorship or not being able to talk about certain things because of conflicting interests or sponsors and whatnot?
How much does it matter to me personally? Is that something that I do?
Yeah.
Okay. I think it's really important. What's happening... So I started writing the script for Hodo Buzz I think around 2014, right? And then that was when a lot of digital media like BuzzFeed or, you know, Huffington Post were really on the rise. You know, they started getting nominated for Pulitzer Prize for journalism and stuff like that. But now if you look at, you know, where the media is, in the States we keep talking about, you know, local journalism is dying because, you know, they can't really monetize efficiently anymore. It's journalism is a hard, it's a really difficult business to pull off to begin with. And now that, you know, the social media and, you know, all the other, you know, changing landscape, making it really unstable to sustain reliable journalism. So what's, especially when we talk about Japan, what's really disconcerting to me is the lack of interest almost in the legacy media, like newspaper and TV station, news programs on TV. And it's really easy to be, you know, jaded or express pessimistic opinions about the media, but the thing is that we do need big corporations, you know, these big newspaper companies and TV stations to really conduct long term investigating journalism. You know, I think the biggest gap between Hodobuzz and what journalism is in reality is it's not a, you know, sexy trade. It takes a long time, and then you work on one topic for months on end, and then you don't get a story out, you know. And then in the meantime, the company has to feed these people. So you need, as a business, we need these companies to be successful. But that's not happening in Japan. Your newspaper, you know, the circulation is dwindling every year. They are having layoffs every year. The business is not really, you know, blooming. That's really dangerous, I think.
Do you think it's possible for a news company to be successful without advertising and without sponsors? And without state funding?
I think ideally, well, maybe I should say this first. I'm no expert, right? I wrote the script for Hodobuzz, but I don't have actual experience of being a journalist. I'm just saying this for the listeners. It's just a layman's opinion about journalism. Mm-hmm. But I think it's important to have different types of business model, like different business models for journalism. We have, you know, subscription business model for news sources. We have, you know, some people pay to get like newsletters from reputable journalists. State funding, because wait, what's the question? I don't think I'm not really answering your question, am I?
So Hodobuzz is trying to be successful without like sponsors and ads and stuff, right?
Right.
And do you think that's like realistic?
I can't imagine a small company starting out without having the ad support. It, like, how would you get the funding, right? You can do crowdfunding, and some very reputable journalists in Japan try that idea. Unless you're a really, really famous person, like really established person, you just can't get enough traffic or funding. I don't know. That's my opinion. What do you think?
Well, I'm having a hard time thinking of any examples of like successful media companies that don't run a lot of advertising and have sponsors. And so I can't think of any media companies that, you know, don't potentially have large conflicts of interest in various areas that I'm not aware of. And I think that's a problem for credibility.
Yeah, so there are rare cases where I think it's the Guardian in the UK. I think it's running off of the funds, this like rich person in the past, they put together these funds and then they are using that, but they are still selling ads. BBC, NHK, but still like they are susceptible to getting influenced, right? So we definitely like watch あの大きい会社とかだとそのオーディエンスもすごく大きいから、その癒着とか広告とあのエディトリアルの、セパレーションとかもちゃんとみんなが見たりとか注意するとかっていうのもできると思うんですけど、小さい会社が、小さい会社で始めて、でそこがこう腐敗しないように見張るシステムみたいなのはすごい難しいなと思いますね。
個人的には何だろう、今その、まあ、広告もそうだし、やっぱり日本の大手の、メディアの中でそれやっぱり政治部と政府の中の人たちの距離が近すぎる問題っていうのがあのまずあるから、そこが、まあ、その広告とか広告主から影響を受けるっていうのはもちろんあのリスクだし問題なんだけれども、その政治部問題っていうのがすごい根深いなと思っていて、それはどう思います？
そこにやっぱりあの国民の関心もありますよね。私もすごいそこに関心があるし、あの、うん、一つ一つのその事件、例えばなんだっけ、 The top prosecutor was caught like gambling with newspaper employees, right? その事件自体もなんか、まあ、あの悪い良くないなと思うんですけど、あの新聞記者が それに関わってたんだとかってことは、その新聞社の人も多くの記者の人がその事実を知ってたわけだし、でそれをなんで書かなかったんだろうとか、書こうとした人はいたのかなとか、あのじゃあ書こうとしたけどそれが書かないって判断になったのはなんでなんだろうとか、その内部の仕組みみたいなところが不透明だから、不信感を持つんだと思うんですよね。
なんかその私もやっぱり社会部で真相に頑張って働いている記者の人たちの知り合いとかもいて、なんだろう、同じ会社なんだけど政治部と社会部で全くもう本当に違う会社みたいな、もう真逆のことをやっているというか、どんなに社会部が頑張っても政治部が、政府の広報みたいな感じで機能してしまっていたりとか、あの、まあ、ただそこやっぱり人間の心理もあるから、どうしてもこう毎日会って会食したりとか、まあ、質問したりとかしてるうちに、まあ、相手も人間だから、あ、この政治がすごい頑張ってるなとか、まあ、みんなは分かってないけど自分は分かってるから擁護したくなっちゃうみたいな気持ちは分からなくもないんだけれども、なんとなくこうあまり監視っていう意味で機能してないような時が多いから、それは結構問題ですよね。
そう思います。あの読者の、あとその読者の関心がないと、それに怒る人がいないと多分歯止めが効かないんだろうなと想像するんですけど、そういう意味でもやっぱり、内部事情みたいなものにを知りたいなと個人的には思うんですけど、
ね、やっぱりこう普通の一般市民からなかなか見えにくいから、そういう、まあ、社内でどうなってるとか、どういう、なんだろう、例えばその社会部の記者の人ですごく頑張ってるんだけど、頑張りすぎてこう、なんだろう、政府内の不正を暴こうとして頑張りすぎて、まあ、左遷されてしまうとか、それって普通にあることなので、それがどこまでこう一般の国民に認知されてるのかなっていう。
そうですよね。あとあのよく、まあ、大手の新聞社ですごい賞を取るようなジャーナリズムの仕事をしてた人が急に報道じゃない部に移動されたりするのも、その今まさにマミさんが言ったみたいに、これ左遷なのか左遷じゃないのかみたいな、で本人は別にツイッターとかで話せるわけではないので、あの想像するしかないと思うんですけど、そもそもそのジャーナリストだった人がジャーナリストじゃなくなるっていう日本のその雇用形態 そのジョブが、会社によって変えられるっていうこと自体が、あの、まあ、北米に長く住んでる私としてはすごく違和感があるんですけど、違和感がありますので、やめてくださいというかちょっとおかしいですよね。その仕事をジャーナリズム、まあ、会社がその何をするかを決めてしまう、でそれでその労働市場ん雇用しんなんて言うんだっけ、その簡単に中途採用とか他もやってるんだったらいいですけど、日本ってそんなに簡単じゃないので、すごくあのアンバランスな関係の中で仕事を変えられたりするのってすごくあの仕事の質的にも良くないし、会社的にもなんでそれが得になるんだろうっていうのが理解できないんですけど、できません。
What do you think about what's shown on TV? And do you think to what extent is like what's on TV like controlled or limited either by government influence or I mean we don't I guess we don't really know and you know none of us are experts but it's interesting to think about.
Yeah, definitely. You can definitely see traces of omission, right? You see, I don't want to, for example, if you make a TV show, and if the TV show, the core concept of the TV show is about, you know, spreading misinformation, right? Then you cannot have the villain of the show just random guy online, and not portraying the you know what TV or movies in Japan have done in terms of reproducing, you know, discrimination or spreading misinformation and stuff like that. Like, there's so Hodobuzz was created by a team of three people, and I'm the screenwriter. Mari Kawade is director, Maho Honda is the actress, and all of us play also act as producers. When we set out to create Hodobuzz, one thing that I really wanted to make sure is that, well, if we talk about the media, we have to talk about TV and newspaper. It's not these like people with, you know, ill intentions online who can harm other people. No, the responsibility is much, much bigger. The blame is much bigger on TV and newspaper. And if you turn on your TV, and then if the TV show is about journalism in Japan, and if the journalists or the organization who pursue journalism are this, righteous savior or righteous heroes that fight the corrupt government or, you know, the chase after evil criminals, then that's only, you're only talking, you know, half of it. You know, I feel like as is often the case with many Japanese organizations, the enemy is within the organization, or sometimes the organization itself, or sometimes the little voices in your head that, you know, forces you to think about what second thinks of you. Mm-hmm. So I definitely see that avoidance of really, you know, I'm sorry guys, can I just put on my sunglasses because the sun is really in my face. I just recently moved and I don't have curtains for this room, so it's really...
Oh, right.
How did you... Sorry to change the topic, but I'm really curious. How did you end up in Toronto?
That's a really good question, Michael.
Yeah.
So I moved to New York right after I graduated from university, 2008. And I was there for 10 years. And around 2016, something happened. Someone came in office in the White House, and the things became really unstable and uncertain. And I was already married, to a man. By the way, I'm gay. So we, and then luckily my partner had a an opportunity to transfer to Toronto. So after, and then it was a combination of many factors, you know, both of us being foreigners in the States and, you know, where our families are and stuff like that. So we decided, change the scenery.
Hmm.
How do you like it? Is it nice?
It's different. I like it. Yeah, I like it. I'm not lying, Canadian.
You hesitated. Okay? You hesitated a little bit.
It's so different. It's so different because I was actually talking about it with one of my friends. It's hard to think about. It's hard to talk about a city, and I'm talking about New York City, where you spent your early 20s or late 20s, where you, you know, learn a lot of stuff as an adult, and then you have a lot of hopes and dreams. So I obviously have a lot of emotion, like, you know, sentiments attached to the city. And then now I'm here in Toronto in a much more, you know, neutral mind space. So when I think about, like when I compare the two cities, I'm like, do I like New York City better than Toronto or do I like Toronto better? It's just, it's never easy. I miss New York City, but I sometimes feel like I miss being young, if you know what I mean.
そういうことか.
Yeah. No, it's a really great functioning city.
And are you okay?
You can totally, like, if you can close the curtains or something.
No, he doesn't have curtains.
No, I have curtains. Right. That's the thing. Yeah, I'm poor.
Can you put one of those picture frames up there maybe or something?
Oh. No, I think it's... Ooh,
can you hear me? Okay. なんかね、部屋の中なんだけど超絶眩しそうなんで。
I'm completely washed out. Yeah, you guys are squinting. No, so there is a tree in front of my window. And then that pretty much covers... I think it's like five... If I don't die within 5 minutes, I'll be fine. After 5 minutes, I'll be covered.
Okay, so the earth just needs to rotate.
No, yeah.
なんかめっちゃ顔日焼けしそうだもん。めっちゃ日焼け。てか部屋の中でね、サングラスしてるのが面白すぎ。
You look like you're on Japanese TV.
Oh, okay.
あ、治った。
I feel like this, yeah. You guys can keep talking.
I have a question. I'm really ignorant about this, but if you are a Japanese citizen, right? I mean, you're Japanese, right? You were born in Japan.
Yeah, I was born and raised in Japan.
So if you're Japanese and then if you get married in the States or Canada, like 例えば私はハワイで結婚して、それをまあ日本の役所に あの、何?ライセンスを出したら日本でも、あ、OK、わかりましたって感じなんだけど、そのゲイマリッジの場合、それってもう日本に、もう日本ではないことになるっていうこと?
They don't know about our marriage, mommy.
Oh. Well, you already talked about it. So it's too late.
Yeah, so I don't know, maybe it's an interesting experiment what they would say if I go to the Japanese embassy here. I've never tried. It didn't even occur to me. I knew it would be just a waste of time, and I'm not that committed to, you know, I shouldn't say that. I'm not ready to, like, you know, sue the government and all that. Like, so I... we got married in New York, and that's it.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It's been nice.
Yeah, marriage is cool, yeah.
It really, like, it makes you feel like you're an adult. That's what. Yeah, that's the biggest
I know what you mean. Well, got it.
Can you elaborate on that, for better or worse?
It is what it sounds like. I don't think I've changed.
You said like, you like feeling young, and then you said getting married makes
you
feel
true,
like an adult.
Yeah, true, true. I think it's... I also feel like people treat you differently. Like, their reaction to... their reaction to you, like, when you introduce yourself and then you reveal that you're married, there's this, like, I don't know, I feel like, and I think it's wrong to feel this way, but I think people feel more secure or relaxed or, like, less, much less tension in the conversation. Like, it's like, oh, okay, I can put this guy in this box who is married. You know what I mean?
Like, you're kind of, you're not going to do anything crazy. You're not unpredictable. You have more to lose.
Oh, yeah.
You have more responsibilities.
Yeah. Maybe that's that. Like, oh, this guy must be somewhat responsible. You know?
Yeah. You have someone telling you what to do.
Yeah.
Hey, it feels like...
That's not like what it is.
It feels like I do that to men. I mean...
Oh, yeah. Like, I mean, I think that's a real threat for a lot of women. Like, you... Because it's... men are evil.
No, but it's like, なんていうのね, sexually harmless. It's like when a guy says, oh, I'm married, it's like, oh, okay, like, you know, you're not going to try to do anything weird. You know, sometimes
but that could be a fake, too, or a false sense of security.
Yeah, sometimes, you know, it doesn't matter to them, but at least, you know, ちょっとだけは. Sexually harmless 感が醸し出される気はする。
Yeah, I think sometimes, and it doesn't happen at all to me, but sometimes I think people get in a situation where you can't really tell if the other person is flirting with you or not, or if the other person is just being friendly or polite. So I think marriage or just a statement of, you know, of you being married, people use that as like, this is the boundary, or like, you know, I'm not flirting, or, you know, don't, you know, get crazy ideas, you know.
But why doesn't that happen to you?
Oh, people don't flirt with me. Does that happen to you?
Sometimes.
Well, good for you.
What? It has to happen to you sometime. Like, maybe not right now. Maybe because you're married, you have a different vibe, but... I'm sure.
Yeah.
In,
I mean,
in the past, people have flirted with you. It has happened at some point.
It has, yeah.
At least once.
After all.
I wish I could share this screenshot with everybody right now because
I'm
just
suffering.
Can't get over
You should. I should take a screenshot right now.
I just can't get over it. It's so funny.
Isn't this beautiful here?
I know. Look. That's what I was thinking. Like, because I live on, like, 10階以上?
Mm-hmm.
なんかその木がもうないの。その窓から木がもう見えないから
その木の今影が司さんの部屋に見えててそれすごい羨ましい。自然って感じで。
We need CRISPR for those ultra tall trees.
そうだね。カナダ行ったことないんだよね。
Yeah, Canada I think is actually it has a lot of like destinations for your vacation, but it's really important to lower your expectations before you come. It's
why?
Not, it's never. Well, it's. I mean, that's. No.
My expectations weren't that high, honestly.
No,
now I'm lowering them even more.
What I mean by that is that it's a really it's got many things. It's got like really fun markets or like, you know, downtown area or like theater scene is really big, you know, a lot of like nature is great, like snowboarding. Well, I guess like if you're into snows, like winter sports, like you can have high expectations and we can, you know,
I love snowboarding.
Get away with it. Oh, yeah. So I think this is a great place for you. But in terms of like sightseeing, there's the fall and there's, you know, tower and stuff, and it's fun, you know, because it's really condensed to one area, so you get to see a lot of things in one day or two. And there are
what
beaches.
Else is there?
There are beaches, so we have a lot of lakes. So there are beaches and people like surf in the lake. We have a lot of cottages. We have what do you call that? the light thing, aurora.
Aurora borealis?
Mm, yeah. Aurora.
And, cool. Do you have to go way up to see that, or can you see that from Toronto?
So if you have a car, it's not... it's not... I think if you drive... There is a place that you can drive like 3 or 4 hours up like north. Mm. And then there is... But it's also... like it's not always there, right? You can't really schedule your visit.
Have you seen it?
No, not really. Actually, no. Yeah, I'm interested. Yeah, I wanna see it.
I like Canadian people. I've only had pleasant experience with Canadian friends and Canadian men.
Can I ask you why?
Well, I've met Canadian men that were really hot, and like the hottest men, except for my husband, yeah. Like the hottest men I've met in my life were, well, there were like two guys, and they were both Canadian. So
were they Ryan Reynolds?
Two people.
No. Oh, okay. But you know, up there, like they were pretty hot.
You apply that to just Canadians.
Yep. So, that's like, whenever someone says, like, I'm Canadian, I'm like, oh, yeah, I love Canadian people.
Reminds me of those two guys.
And, of course, there's Justin.
Justin Trudeau?
Yeah. I mean, I know that... No. Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, Bieber, too, but I guess.
I genuinely thought you meant Bieber.
No, I was talking about Trudeau, but, yeah, Justin Bieber is hot, too. Yeah. I mean, Trudeau is not perfect, I know. But, I mean, I'm in Japan, and I don't know.
I think he really helped Canada raise like visibility, like as a liberal country.
Yeah.
The brand value of him was really
Who was
high.
The leader? Who was the leader before Trudeau? Do you know?
I have no idea.
No, exactly, though, right? I mean,
Narimo kind of... Yeah, that's the point, I guess.
Narimo そこまで注目してなかったけど, ね, Trudeau が来てから、すごいニュースになるから、日本でもニュースになるから。
Yeah, he's really photogenic, and that helps with, you know, marketing or branding of Canada.
Have you seen that, what is it, Trudeau is like the, I forget what it is, like the... grandson or son of Castro or something. There's like some crazy conspiracy theories about his past or where he came from.
No.
he seems like the nicest, least like Castro type guy, but
no, I didn't know about that. I know he was criticized for like doing blackface in his high school photos and stuff. But he's also from a political like dynasty. His father was a PM too. No, but I wasn't aware of the conspiracy theory. I have to Google that later.
Well, he looks like Castro when Castro was very young. They look very similar, and it's just. I guess it's just an unfortunate coincidence, or fortunate, because Castro was handsome when he was young. I don't know. But, yeah. I don't know that much about your job.
I mean, Sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
No, I mean, just the fact that your prime minister's name is Justin, like... Do you know what I mean? Like, in Japan, like, most politicians are, like, in their 70s. And,
wait, is it Yoshikazu?
I don't know his first name, actually. Suga-san de shou? Demo nan daro? Nan te
nan ne? What is his first name?
We don't have any Justin here, so...
It's not Justin, that's for sure.
Yeah. Justin. Yeah, it's not Justin.
Yeah, no, yeah, everyone's, like, old.
How did you become a writer?
Ne, sore kininaru.
I always liked writing. You know, when I was in, I started writing plays and put on the production, like when I was in elementary school, like with the help of the teachers, and I kept on writing. You know, in university, I did like theater productions with our friends, with my friends, and yeah, it's always been my passion. But I think it was only after I moved to New York City, and then I started writing professionally. I got, you know, commissions to write really interesting, like international plays, like half Japanese, half English plays for theater. And then I, our team, it's called Deruk. It comes from Derukui. Derukui wa utareru. It's a team of three Japanese people in New York, based in New York. And we formed the team and created our first mini-series. That was my transition to video productions. And then our second project is Hodobuzz. And Hodobuzz had a supervisor for the scripting phase, and his name is Dai Sato. He's a really established anime screenwriter, and we worked on the script of Hodobuzz for about 2 years together, like monthly Skype sessions and many drafts, rewrites. And then after Hodobuzz, I started working with him as a co-writer for anime productions, because Netflix right now is producing a lot of anime content based on like IPs originally in English, like video games, or you know, their original live action shows or novels, what have you. And they were really looking for writers with bilingual capacity. So luckily, I landed one job, and I've been writing for them too since.
What was the process for getting your first like job, like paid, like how do you become a writer?
So I'm a freelancer, and I think most, if not all, writers are freelancers. You have the first experience was I was hired by this cultural organization in Manhattan called the Japan Society, and they have this theater arm, and they decided to put together a theater production for children. And I had worked with the institution before as an actor, and then I'd always expressed my, you know, interest in writing. So, and then I had been sending my materials to producers and directors. So, and they were like, okay, do you want to write for this production? This is how much we're going to pay. Sign here and here. And then that was, and then it was like, $500 for a play or something. It was really, really low. And then once you have that experience, it's much easier for you to pitch yourself to other productions. But it's interesting. Every writer has a different story for their start, like professional career start. But I think the most traditional, because I didn't go to a film school or writer's school. I didn't, you know, I don't have master's in creative writing or stuff like that. So, but that's what a lot of people do. And then after graduating, they get a job as a assistant job to writer or like film productions. And then you'll take notes from meetings, or you put together documents for proposals and stuff like that, and then you get hired for a staff writer or something like similar title, and then you keep getting hired as a staff writer, and then at one point you want to pitch your own idea. So that's how you move up the ladder. I think that's a traditional career path, but a lot of people you know, get in this industry in a, a weird way.
その脚本を書くプロセスっていうか、どうやって書くのかというか、I mean, it's a ぼんやりした question, but
It's different for each project, but I think as a general tendency, I think theater, when it's a play, you tend to have a lot of workshops or readings with the actors, and then you do rewrites through the interaction with the director and writers. But anime is really interesting because anime takes a long time, and so the script needs to be finished before they start creating animation. So even, and especially if it's a 3D anime story, then they'll tell you like how many principal characters we need and then how many locations we can use, because 3D modeling is really expensive, right? So you can only, that like other than, they will say like other than the three leading characters, you can't really have other characters act in a meaningful way or something like that, right? And then the designs or the location, once they, okay, so we're going to use a castle for this scene, if we are making a whole like 3D model of a castle, then like we better use it as many times as possible, because that's how you save money. Or like you can, but it's really different for live action show, because live action show you can just use one location and just never use it again, you know. I think with live action show, what are the cost points? Yeah, I think live action show, you don't want to have a lot of like a mob scene, what we call like people with like 100 people in one scene, or one, you know, it tends,
how much
to
would that
expensive.
Cost?
I have no idea. I think
for like 100 people,
if you do that, it
costs more than a castle. A virtual castle. It's not even a real castle.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I think with SAG in the US, SAG is the Screen Actors Guild, and if you use SAG actors for like background actors, I think the minimum is $250 a day, maybe even more, $300 a day. And if you have 100 people, then you do the math. It's probably still cheaper than a castle.
The castle is interesting. Like it's virtual, but you had to pay these people to create the model, right?
Yeah.
And then once
yeah.
they've created it, it's like an asset. It's like, hey, we need to make the money back out of this asset that we spent a bunch of time making, right?
Like, do they ever recycle the same castle in different like projects? Or
I think they do, and also they buy models from you know their vendors, especially if you don't have to show the detail of the design, right? If it's like one castle from a distance, then you can just buy a castle model from Costco or something, or the equivalent of Costco, and then you can use
just
it in the back.
Acme castle.
Yeah,
but you can sell your castle too, right?
I think so. I'm sure there's some business.
Are you just out there selling castles? Like selling? Are you a virtual castle salesman?
Me?
Castle vendor. So, it's interesting to think about this, you know, from the production side, you know, even moving into digital, there's still going to be cost considerations like that, and you have to manage these assets as if they were, you know, physical things.
And it changes by the month. What I was told when I first started writing for anime productions, I think it was 4 years ago, I was told that water is expensive, especially if you have something in the water and move, then they have to create waves and stuff, and that's going to be expensive. But then so they'll tell you like you can have a river in the scene, but don't let the characters go in there, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Which wouldn't be a problem that, you know, in live action shows. But I was recently working with an anime studio, and they were like, "Oh yeah, we're good with water. Like we're really like that's our one of our you know fortes and something like that."
What's
じゃあ今は何が高いんだろう?
I don't know. I mean, these things I know just because it's related to script writing, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not an animator. My background is not like the production of anime, so I don't know. I wonder.
Do you have to sometimes fight for something? Like, no, these characters have to go into the river. Like, do you...
He drowns.
Fight for
yeah,
something like that?
But the budget for the project has been set already, right? So you have to accommodate that. So if you want to use water, then you have to... something's got to give, right? If you have to compromise. Mm. So they'll say, okay, well, then I can do without the castle, you know?
Mm.
Water or castle.
そうか。面白い。でもだから、
so、you...
sorry, the story がもう決まってて、そこからどういうこう、アロケーションというか、このシーンがどの長さで、誰がどれぐらい喋ってとかは、スクリーンライターが決めるっていうこと?
So I only know anime productions with Netflix. I'm just a newbie in this industry. But whenever I talk to Dai-san, Dai Sato, who's written like so many anime productions on TV or you know DVD and stuff like that, like there it's outside of Netflix, there's so many other restrictions or requests from the either a TV station or anime studio. For a long time, anime business is about creating merchandise and selling it, right? So it was important for them to know how, for example, like how this robot, like, you know, how many, like how they transform from being a car to a humanoid, you know, something like that. And then you have to use these unique characteristics in the show, or something like that. So there are many restrictions that I'm not like really that I don't have experience dealing with. I completely forgot what you asked me. What was the question?
Screenwriter がやる仕事の内容としてそのストーリーはもう決まってて、そこからこうスクリプトに落とし込む作業のやり方が全然想像できないから、
okay.
そこが興味ある。
I think, again, it depends on the project, but the traditional way to go about it is you create a very, very general like plot. This is the beginning, this is the middle, this is the end of the whole season, if it's a series, or the whole movie, right?
Mm.
And then if that stage, if that pitch is bought, if that's like green-lighted, then you go create plot the same document for each episode. Or if it's a movie, then you break the plot into scenes or into more... detailed like story points, and then actually writing dialogue is the very very last, especially with anime production, because they need to know, they need to make sure that everything will be within the budget. So, and then they can assess that based on the plot without the dialogue or detailed action and stuff like that. So they lock that first, and then we start writing details.
Hmm.
How do you decide on the really general plot? You know how there's an expression that there's only like three stories that exist? You know, all the stories have a beginning, middle, and end. Usually there's like a hero and there's some challenge.
Yeah.
and it looks like, you know, they're not going to make it. And then, you know, there's like this arc that stories tend to have. And how much do you use that some kind of like arc story archetype skeleton to build the plot?
Okay, so that's not something that will come from the producers. I think writers have to come up with the arc. And the thing is, statistically, they tend to fall into like these general, you know, categories. What happens a lot of times in the meetings with the director or producers or animators is that you'll reference other works in the past, and it's not limited to anime movies or shows. And then you say, well, this arc didn't work with this show, so we have to change the ending. They'll give you feedback from just reading the script, saying that this middle part is dull. You have to like shorten it or something like that. So in my style, it doesn't start from the kata or like formats that are like established, because I usually start with something that's provocative, like either it's visually or philosophically, like something provocative. And if the scene is feels alive with that concept, then I'll expand. And then in the very end, or towards the end, I kind of play around the structure of it.
なんかその職業病みたいのあります？なんかその自分が普段映画とかテレビ見てるときに、なんかドラマ見てるときに、こう脚本家目線で見てしまうとか。
Oh yeah, absolutely. That's something that I do, and I think my partner really hates it. Is that at the very, like within 10 minutes or so, I say like I list possible endings, like I would like hypothetical endings for the movie. I will say like, oh, either he's gonna die, or he's the villain, or you know, the roommate, you know, whatever. And then I take pleasure in doing that. But my partner doesn't understand.
That's a lot of fun, though, right? I like shows that sort of prompt me to guess, and sort of make me. I mean, it's not. Interactive, but it feels more interactive, you know, because the show can kind of set me up to have certain expectations.
And they sometimes betray your expectation, and that's the best part, and you get more engaged.
It has to be tasteful, though. But
I'm the opposite.
You don't like that?
No, I like not guessing. So I like to have no expectation. So like, なんか実はこうなんだろうなとかも考えたくない。もうなんか真っ白の状態で見て、あの普通にびっくりさせてほしいみたいな。
So you don't like it if they suddenly wake up and it was a dream or something like that. They're in a UFO. Some plot twist.
What? What?
I'd watch that. But
you wake up in a UFO? I'd watch it.
Yeah.
I'm in.
But Mami-san, then what does it mean to you when a movie or TV show is boring? What does that mean to you? How do you get bored if it's not related to like expectations?
Well, if I can't care about the characters,
yeah.
Like for example, I was watching The Walking Dead, and then they came out with a spin-off. I forgot what it was called. And then I was watching
Fear the Walking Dead.
Yes. I didn't care about any of them. So, so naruto nanka, ah, mo, nanka, I don't care if they die or if they live. Nanka, dou demo iya, mitaina. So naruto mirenai kamoshirenai.
Yeah, I understand. So I have a soft spot for, movies and TV shows that are about like gay relationships or gay coming of age stories for obvious reasons. And that's completely different. For me, it's really different. You know, the way I consume stories like that, because then it becomes about, you know, empathizing and relating, you know, all these, and then I would like root for the character, and then I just wish for a positive ending for the characters, and that to me is a better experience, but it doesn't really happen a lot. But it can happen with like anything else. It doesn't have to be gay related shows, but when I do, when I watch TV shows or movies that way, I don't think about like plot and twists and, you know, expectations. Yeah.
When you try to guess what's going to happen, do you tell that to your partner when you're watching it together? Or is it just in your head?
It's always in my head. When something is obvious or when something is interesting enough, then I'll say it. But I don't think my partner takes a lot of joy out of joy out of me telling him what's going to happen. So I'll whenever I feel like, I think whenever I'm bored, I just want to point things out.
Right. Do you know on, I think it's Spotify or one of those music platforms, but when you play the song in the browser, little comments pop up as the song plays at different parts. So if it's like a trance song and it's like reaching some crescendo, there's going to be a bunch of comments there.
No, I don't know. And that's interesting.
You haven't seen that?
No.
I would love to see the movie version of that, you know, where you can just see comments embedded in the time.
Nikodo,
isn't that Nikodo? Yeah,
the movie.
Yeah, that's
Nikodo. Oh, they have that.
Well, I don't think they do that with
good?
Movies, but you can.
I'd like
see,
to see like, that with like Bambi. I want to see, or like whatever different movies.
Crying emojis. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the live comments are fun, I guess.
But
yeah.
Like, I want to hear, you know. Like, I'd want to watch the same thing that Scottsdale watched and then see his little prediction or his little comment. You know, because maybe I want to talk during a movie, but, you know, my girlfriend doesn't like if I, you know, crap on the movie. But maybe somebody else can,
actually,
you know, maybe we can crap on the movie.
Actually, people do that a lot on Twitter. So, like, people watch something together. Like, let's just watch this movie from 9 p.m., and then just random people join with a hashtag and they just talk.
Oh, actually, I think Netflix and Amazon, they have that function.
Like, yeah?
I think it's called Watch Party, or maybe it's an extension on Chrome. But yeah, like can have a video call while you watch the same title.
What have you been watching lately?
That's a loaded question.
Sort of things have you been watching?
last night I just watched the documentary called The Social Dilemma.
Oh, everyone's talking about it
on
right?
Netflix.
I haven't seen it, but
yeah, I think for the two of you who are already really savvy with the topic, you know, the subject of the movie, which is about how social media, you know, the algorithm, machine learning it's just a machine that keeps getting better at manipulating people for attention, you know, slightly changing their behaviors over time for ad money. But it's a well presented, you know, well structured documentary that even people with very little idea of what social media is doing to them will understand, you know, how big of a threat it is. So yeah, I mean, you wouldn't be like shocked, because these are like, these people that are on the show and giving their testimonies or like talking about their discoveries, they've published books, or they've, you know, they've been interviewed for articles and stuff like that, so there's no like bombshell revelation. But it's a really, really well put together a documentary. It's worth a watch.
What's your impression after watching that? Do you think that you are being manipulated by an algorithm, or where are all of us are being manipulated by AI algorithms? Like right now?
Yes, I think it's, before watching that movie, I think I used to think, it's a lot of, less educated people or less, yes, like more people than I thought. That
just, not you. Before you watched it, it was like, not me. I'm chilling.
And then after I wouldn't you be surprised. It, I think that's the scary part of it. Like, I wouldn't be that aware, because all these people that were like CEOs of like this and that, you know, Pinterest or Twitter or, you know, these like top engineers, they say like, even though I created the system, I can't, like, I get addicted to social media. Right, so that effect, yeah, definitely I'm not like immune to it. And this is where I talk about my personal rules about social media and lose friends. But on Facebook and also Twitter, what I do is I'm friends with like people, but I, what's the terminology, unfollow, like I unfollow everybody. So when I log into Facebook, I just see gray wall, nothing, like even ads, they don't show up. The reason why I still have a Facebook account is that some people, that's the only, you know, means of communication with some people, like, you know, friends from high school or whatever. So I need to maintain that. But other than that, I don't want to open Facebook and get hooked and like spend hours like watching stupid stuff. So
how pervasive do you think the algorithm's influence is? Because if we have algorithms operating in this way in Google and in Facebook and Twitter and other social media, and presumably in our news outlets, or at least influencing the people who control news outlets and make material for news outlets. I mean, is it possible that like the entirety of human civilization is like, you know, being sliding away from base reality? Like all of us, like together.
I think that's one of the big like core messages of the documentary. I really recommend that you watch that. I think the threat is, it really sort of like detaches you from your reality. You don't even have to like communicate with other people. You're getting spoon fed.
It's weird how it has such a synergy with all of us having to stay at home, you know, in front of our screens. It's like the algorithm caused this, but it's extremely good timing for both, I suppose.
Yeah,
it's made it harder to deal with the algorithm, and it's made it harder to deal with the bullies.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely harder because there's so many positive things coming out of this, right? And they talk about that in the documentary too. If you remember when Japan was having the top prosecutor, you know, Mahjong scandal, and then I think it was and then one person started tweeting some hashtag that calls for his resignation or something like that. And then it became a movement, and then they actually put the revision of the law on hold. So there it is giving power to people that didn't have power before. So there's definitely positive things coming out of this. So it's I think that the challenge is, you know, the solution cannot be, okay, let's just get rid of all these social media channels and be done with it, because obviously we can't live without it.
What should we do?
Regulation.
Have you noticed that people believe different things more and more over time? Or is it just the impression that I have? Like, people believe the range of things that people believe, the sort of collection of different things that people believe seems so much more diverse and bizarre than it's ever been.
Yeah.
As far as I can tell.
Yeah, I think, yeah, I think I feel the same way. And also we are more...
Like flat earth.
Oh, yeah.
It's solid. It's solid.
Yeah. Because there's like ad money behind it, right? Because people make money out of people believing in conspiracy theories and radicalizing and polarizing audience is like lucrative. It's good money, you know. I mean, it's bad, but someone's getting rich.
The algorithm says it makes money, right? And if you don't, if you work for one of these companies and you interfere with the algorithm, you'll be fired.
Yeah. I think so. All these like top engineers being interviewed in the documentary, they have, you know, a lot of them, I think, left their companies because they had conscience, you know, they like for ethical reasons, and then now they're on the show speaking against or speaking for more regulations on social media, exactly because they felt bad, you know, they felt like they created a monster.
Do you know of any other shows or movies that sort of tell stories that involve this kind of problem? Like, is this
Black Mirror?
Black Mirror is more of a prediction, I feel like.
Yeah. No, not that I know of.
I mean, we have like the Terminator and like Skynet,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And Skynet becomes conscious or whatever. That's still a little ways out there. We have the Terminators now. Terminator's no problem. You know, Boston Dynamics can whip up a Terminator.
Yeah.
And we have AI for, you know, like the Spot dogs. I don't know if you've seen those, but we have sophisticated AI that's sort of T-800 Terminator level AI.
Yeah.
But we don't have Skynet yet, and that's the biggie, I guess. And if we have all these different if we have all these different countries competing to create this very powerful artificial intelligence, it's almost like the nuclear race all over again, right? It's like these countries are racing to be the first ones to develop some kind of super weapon, or in this case a super intelligence. What do you think? Is this crazy talk?
No, but I think American companies, and I'm saying this only because I just watched the movie, and the impression of like what are the entities that have the biggest impact is these like Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all these like private entities in the States, and they are that big and influential because of lack of regulations. At least that's what I got out of. That's a takeaway. For me, and maybe it's just I don't know, but it felt like more about if you let the whole thing was the algorithm or these platforms, you know, they're not serving its users, right? They're serving the advertisers. So they're not, if you create something like that, and then if it, you know, if you let it do what it does best, then of course it's going to go in the direction of manipulating the users and, you know, radicalizing and polarizing. So I think it's this very concept of machine getting, you know, machine that keeps getting better on its own. And then its sole goal is to manipulate users for more attention and screen time, then that there will be really bad consequences.
Right. The goal is not to make people happy, right? So like, I mean, I spend a lot of time on Twitter, and I realize how people love getting angry. So, you know, all kinds of articles that would make you angry, you know, get the most attention. And it's really interesting, yeah, because it's this like human nature thing where, you know, we really like being angry. And so, like, その polarizing な、あの、記事とかもそうだけど、they get attention because we love being pissed off. And that's something that I didn't know when I was growing up, like when I was a child. Now it's kind of obvious, but なんかそれを考えたことなかったから。
It also makes people insecure. A lot of, you know, young girls particularly, they feel much more insecure and unhappy about their how they look, you know, or how they are perceived by their peers.
Yeah.
That's also another big thing.
Yeah, it's so tough.
I think boredom might be a big part of it too, you know, like when you're bored, you're already a little bit in, you're not in a happy mood when you're bored, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, oh, gee, I'm bored. What's going on? And then you start looking at your phone. So, like, if you were happy, you know, if you were out, you know, paddling down some river or something, you wouldn't be on Twitter. If you were enjoying yourself doing something else, you know, so you're bored and then you get on Twitter, and it's very difficult for some piece of content to, like, make you happy, right? That's pretty rare. Right. How often do you open Twitter and it's like, oh, wow, this is I feel so much better now. Like,
yeah. No.
Like right away.
Yeah.
Like, but it's so easy for some content to sort of be abrasive and like make you feel upset. Right. Like that seems like a much easier target for the algorithm than to make people happy. Even if they asked the algorithm to make people happy, I don't know if it would know how to do that.
Because, I mean, like, there are a lot of, like, nice, heartwarming, wholesome stories or cute cat videos and stuff, and people do like them too, but, you know, you don't really feel the need to comment on it. As opposed to, like, you know, stories that make you angry. Like, people love commenting on it and retweeting with comments and, you know, because you have something to say. And so, I don't know. And going back to what you just said about teenage girls, you know, feeling insecure about how they look and stuff. Like, growing up, I would look at magazines and, you know, I didn't have social media. So, you know, I would look at Britney Spears or whoever famous and, you know, Hollywood actresses. Okay, like, they're so pretty, they're thin, whatever. But, なんだろう、もうセレブだから、自分と全然関係ないし、なんかスペシャルな存在だから自分とそんな比べる必要もないみたいに思えたけど今ってなんかもう everyone is a celebrity, right? So it must be so hard. Like I just watched Paris Hilton documentary and even Paris Hilton was saying like I can't imagine being a 13-year-old girl right now. And I like fully agree.
Yeah, if Paris Hilton says it's hard.
I mean, she said...
I'm sure it's super hard.
I mean, she said but she I feels guess,
yeah, she was under... Yeah, she was under so much, like, much bigger pressure and attention and, like, scrutiny even since young age, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think it's getting harder to be a person, or is it about the same? Or is it easier to be a person now? Like, the kinds of challenges have completely changed, but...
I mean, personally, I don't think it's hard to be off social media or have, like, really nice, like, personal rules about usage in place. Like, it's not that hard, especially if you grow up with your parents or teacher telling you, you know, these are the rules that you have to follow to protect your own, you know, mental health, then I think it will be really easy. It's just right now, it's so wild, and you can, people spend like literally 24 hours, 7 days a week, right? And then there's nothing stopping you. So that's a scary part, but like, imagine if you have strict parents, it's really hard for you to like get away with like being on screen all the time.
I'd break those rules so fast though. And I know way more about like how to look at stuff online.
That's true. Yeah. There's always that generational divide, but
yeah, that gap's going to get even worse. Yeah. Like, you know, in the future, it's going to be totally impossible to know
there are obviously,
how they're accessing their yokai ochi or whatever they're doing.
There are obviously positive things too, though. Yeah. Like, I appreciated Twitter the most right after I gave birth, when I couldn't sleep at all because, you know, I have to take care of the baby, obviously. And sometimes I would, you know, I sleep only for 5 minutes and I'm awake for like 40 hours or something. And I'm literally like dying. And like sometimes at 3 a.m. I have to wake up and I'm feeding my baby and I'm so sleepy and just, I don't know, just so exhausted and I feel super alone. I'll go on Twitter. Someone is doing exactly the same thing as I am. You know, someone is nursing the baby. Like, whenever it is, someone out there is doing it and tweeting. And that really helped me somehow. Like, it, you know, it made me feel less alone.
Yeah, definitely. The first person I came out to that I'm gay was this random American guy in, I think, somewhere in the Midwest on Yahoo chat room. I think I was 16 or 17 whenever, you know, Windows 95 or something. And I was, you know, I was closeted. I was in the closet until I was 24, right before I left Japan. But somehow it was so much easier for me to talk to this random stranger online who was already out to his family. But the conversation didn't go anywhere. He was like, yeah, I'm out. And then like, we had nothing in common to talk about, but just
what did he say? He's just like, that's cool.
I was like, oh, wow, how'd you do that? And he was like, oh yeah, that was scary. But it got better or something like that. I mean, it's just the sheer fact of that someone is happy being gay. You know, that wasn't represented on screen back then. I was desperate for, not just for like personal validation, but also like a role model of like how to be happy, right? Without the internet, I wouldn't have had that. It's just impossible.
Who said this? I think it was Leary that said this, but he said, find the others.
Yeah.
And so a big part of life is like finding cool people or finding people that you need guidance or lessons from. But because the internet exists, you can find almost anybody.
Yeah.
Any kind of person, at least.
Yeah.
Who could have insight or something, you know, something to offer.
Where in Japan are you originally from?
Kobe, Hyogo-ken. Hyogo-ken Kobe-shushin
desu. Were you like, you hadn't told anyone that you were gay like, was there anyone that you knew, like friends or acquaintances or whatever, that were gay or?
I don't think so. When I came out to my friends, for example, there were a few people that told me that, you know, yeah, I had a hunch, you know, I had, like, I thought about it, about you, you know, that kind of thing. But I'd never come out to them from, like, you know, like, actively. It's like, so it's a, so there's this, I think former NBA player, his name is Jason Collins, I think. He's the first active athlete of all the, like, four major, you know, sports, professional sports league in the USA, to come out publicly as gay. And then he described being closeted in a very interesting way, and I agree with it. He said, I always knew I was gay. It's like you look at the sky and then you know it's blue, but you keep telling yourself that it's red. So you knew it, and it's just a fact. It's undeniable fact, but you hope that that's not true. So that's the feeling I had. But you wish it would change, not because you think it's not a real thing, but because you, as a young person, you crave validation, right? Or just being loved. A lot of my friends, you know, they grew up Catholic or some sorts of religion. And then almost all of them, when they were young, they prayed that they were not gay, right? They'll go to bed and next day they'll wake up straight or something like that. To answer your question, they didn't know, but I think, like, no one knew because I never explicitly said. But I think they, quite a few of them saw the struggle or this, like, facade, the wall that I put up around myself. And then some thought something was weird. Yeah.
Do you think, I mean, obviously there are people who are gay that remain closeted their entire life, right? And do you think that's, well, I don't know. Like, do you think it would have been ever possible to, like, what would your life be like if you never, like, came out? I mean, I'm just trying to imagine someone in a situation where they, you know, they weren't able to come out. Maybe they didn't have the courage to come out. I'm sure it takes a lot of courage. It takes a lot of, you know, it's complicated. It's like in your head. So, like, you know, yeah. What do you think that would be like?
It's not a good situation. And I'm not saying that everybody should come out to their family and friends, because sometimes it's just impossible for some people. But I think at least you should come out to yourself. Like, you have to recognize, you have to admit that you're gay and be okay with it. Because if you can't say, yes, you deserve to live, being truthful to yourself, then I think there is really a damaging effect, long-lasting effect. So that's really important. You know, there's reason why the suicide rates among LGBTQ kids in the U.S. dropped significantly after they started legalizing same-sex marriage, right? So the the validation that you give to yourself is really important for your own mental health, but also the validation you get from the society, you get the messages from the you know, the systems and rules and the laws, what they say about who you are. It's not good. I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy.
It seems like you would, I mean, obviously you would have some kind of cognitive dissonance, you know, where it's like what you were saying about the sky, you know, you're telling yourself it's a different color.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I would imagine that a lot of LGBT who are still closeted commit suicide and we wouldn't even know that it had anything to do with, you know, their sexuality or something.
Oh,
how would we ever find out? Like, we wouldn't, right?
Yeah. Interesting. Like, funny thing is, I was never an avid audience. I was never a big fan of movies or TV shows. I didn't really watch TVs or movies growing up. But then I moved to the States and I watched this really corny, gay romance movie, indie movie, which I don't think received any major theatrical distribution, but it was my first time that I cried watching a movie because it had such a positive, happy ending, right? It was about this 18-year-old or a 19-year-old, who's in the closet, and then he finds a partner who is more mature, older, and then shows him, he must be 20 or 21 because he's a minor. This older figure teaches him how to love and how to be loved, and then they become happy in the end. And that was just incredible for me to watch. I surprised myself, by the extent that I'm so touched, you know, it. And then that's when I really realized the power that stories have, you know, and then what it means to relate to the characters on screen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I had that experience with 2001, A Space Odyssey. It was just such a grand, big, the ideas were so big to me. Where did humans come from? Or why are humans different from monkeys and this kind of thing? Or what is, you know, what's life and death and this whole, what's this, what the heck's going on Earth in the first place? I didn't go become a writer like you, so I don't know what my point is. but for me, that was it really opened up a new appreciation for movies and that potential. I mean, it's possible some people just haven't seen a movie like that that really, you know, gets in their head like that. But.
Yeah, I think different people have different entry points to how to authentically.
Mine wasn't gay romance.
Sexuality is weird, right? I mean, I think from young age, especially when we were children, it's kind of being gay or bisexual was not even an option. They've got, you know, in textbooks and stuff, they'll tell you boy and girl, they fall in love, and they were seeing it as if that was the only option. So I've mentioned it on the show a couple times, I think, but when I was in the elementary school, I had a crush on this girl in my class, and I didn't really know anything about, you know, bisexuality or being gay or anything. So I didn't really understand. I didn't even think anything of it. I just really liked this girl. And then from a very young age, I was watching porn. but like at the beginning of my porn days, I was watching all the lesbian porn, you know? And even then, I wasn't really, it didn't register to me that I was interested in women, because in my mind, that wasn't even an option. Like, do you know
why were you watching lesbian porn, though, instead of non-lesbian porn?
Because, well, I think first, like, I was interested in, like, I would get aroused when I look at women. I think women's bodies are hot, and I was a virgin, so I was scared of penises, and, you know, they look invasive and, I don't know, scary. I didn't really understand vagina, like, how it worked either, so lesbian porn was, you know, a way to, you know, that worked for me. but I didn't even, you know, I didn't even think about it. I didn't even... So, I think... It was, I think at one point in life, I was like, actually, I guess I am bisexual. Like, I've been bisexual all my life, but it just didn't register. But, you know, because it was, I could go both ways, I didn't suffer. Do you know what I mean? Because, you know, I was just dating boys, and that looks normal, like, you know, to my family and stuff. So, like, I just can't really imagine what it was like for you. なんていうの? どっちも行けたから、たまたま自分はなんかそこに悩む必要がなかったというか、苦しむことがなかったけど、どっちもじゃなかった時に、その、なんだろう。 気づくとか自分でadmitするまでに時間がかかることがどういう感じなのか想像できないから like I don't know how it happened to you, like when you actually when it registered というか do you know what I mean?
So labels always help, like you said, you grew up and then you learned about, you know, bisexuality, and looking back, it made sense, right? I think it happens with me, but in a much, I think the terminology, you know, gay or okama or homo, existed. Like, it was in my, consciousness even when I was really young, and it was heavily stigmatized. So there were moments like over and over again, like maybe like when I was 10 or 11, I would think about, you know, all these boys like having crushes on girls, but I don't have anything like that or something like that. And then you would see homo da ho, homo on TV, and then you're like, okay, so this, whatever this is, it's like, it's supposed to be disgusting, and I don't want to be this. So why don't I just put a lid on it and not think about it and just play soccer or something like that. And then at a point, it's just your sexuality is so much that you have to, you know, face the music. But still, I mean, like, even with the internet, when I was growing up in the 90s, it, like, there were so many, like, disagreements about, like, what homosexuality was, or it was hard for me to reach the right like literature, you know, the source of information. So one website would say, oh, it's just a phase, you know, it'll pass, you know, a lot of people actually go through it, and then you wish for that to be true, right? Because that's the best case scenario, you can be normal. So it's, you know, moments like that, you go through that, and then at a point, I remember, so when I was 23 or 24, I had already decided to move to New York. And then I was keeping this little journal just to like, keeping track of like what I did on that day. And then like, I had this urge to just write down the statement that I'm gay so that I won't, avoid the fact. So I just wrote like a one page full of like, I'm gay, I'm gay, I'm gay, I'm gay. So as I like it's because I think I needed to like really face it in a way that you can't, because if you don't say it, then it sometimes it makes you feel like it's not real, and it was just in my case it was just extending, you know, the torture or this denial, I guess.
Yeah, it's so, like, I don't know, heartbreaking, because one of my best friends came out to her mom fairly recently, and it was kind of like a very sensitive situation where, like, knowing her mom, no one can tell her, like, oh, you should come out, you know, because it could have gone real bad.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons that, you know, she couldn't come out for so long was because of the media, because, like, you mentioned the homo, but, like, when that kind of stuff comes onto TV and people are laughing and stuff, like, she has seen her mom, you know, making comments about it or laughing along and that kind of stuff. So, you know, that obviously makes it really hard for the kids to come out to their parents. Right? So it's kind of like, なんだろう。あ、なんかそれを通して、あ、自分の親ってこういうふうに思ってるんだって、あの、分かってしまうというか、分かってしまうから、ん、そこはすごく辛いなと思った。
Yeah. Yeah, I really don't have a like a blanket advice to like anyone. Like, I can't say.
It's a very personal journey.
Yeah, it's a very personal journey, and it's, there's no, yeah. And the problem is not you.
Do you think about your life as a story, being a writer? Does your life have an arc? Obviously, there was a beginning. You were born, you know, presumably in Kobe, and, you know, you have drama in your life. You have significant moments in your life, things that changed the course of what you're doing, and obviously challenges that you've overcome. Do you think of it like a story? Are our lives like stories? You know?
Yeah. Or
do we just imagine that?
It helps, right? With me, it helps to have a story to understand or to give meaning to the struggle I had, you know, whatever little struggle I had, and look back and be able to say, like, okay, that happened for a reason, that helps. So I think I have that unconsciously. But, like, for a long time, no, it didn't. Like, I was really, I was just a young man with, like, passion for theater and stories. And I just wanted to do bigger projects. I think if I were not gay, I wouldn't have moved out of the country, like, moved out of the Or if Japan hadn't recognized same-sex marriage, then I wouldn't have left. So there's a lot of
Does your life feel like a story? Do you feel like you're in the Truman Show? Do you have coincidences? Do you have coincidences in your life that are, like, impossible? Because I have it all the time. I'm like, there's no freaking way. You know, there are just coincidences that make it feel like you're in the Truman Show. Or you are living in, like, something that is authored, almost.
Yeah, I mean, I feel I'm lucky all the time. You know, I feel lucky that I got out of the country. I feel lucky that I happen to be bilingual, and then I got this job. in the anime industry, in writing both in English and Japanese, and because of that, I'm getting to work with like all these fantastic creators and all that. Like, I feel lucky, but as far as coincidences, I don't know. So I guess my answer is I don't see it that way, much.
Are you superstitious at all? Or do you believe that things are meaningful or come together like for a reason or anything like that?
I'm not really superstitious. No, really.
What about like ghosts or Bigfoot?
I don't believe in ghosts. I believe in, you know, things that are not discovered yet in the field of science, like that they exist. But I don't believe in ghosts.
Anything supernatural? What about like the? What about Illuminati? Do you believe in like Illuminati or like the what are the guys with the hammers? The Freemasons. You don't think any of that stuff's going on? What about like Epstein's Island and what do you think, like what's going on at the upper levels of like this whole
planet-girdling
technological reef of madness?
I'm very, very interested in these topics, right? I watch like documentaries on them, you know, the space aliens and like Area 51 and stuff like that. I'm really interested. But if the question is, do I truly believe in it, then I guess my answer is I think it's no. But I hope, I don't know. I mean, I'm fascinated. I think I want to believe it.
What about conspiracies around, you know, starting unjust wars or weird conspiracies to control fiat currency or you know, like some sort of petrodollar style conspiracy theories? Are you down with any of those?
What is this?
I'm just
trying to recruit me into your organization.
No,
it's a trap.
We were talking about how people believe different things, and so I'm trying to figure out, are there any funny ideas do believe? And so I'm zeroing in on petrodollar, you know, the Fed. I feel like maybe there's something there, but what do you think? Like, what about the friggin' eyeball and the pyramid on the dollar bill and stuff? You're not feeling any of that?
I think I tend to suspend my own belief. Like, so conspiracy theories tend to be my like, you know, the gateway or like my interest points to start researching about it, right? And then I always go into the topic thinking that, okay, there's gotta be more nuance to it, or there's gotta be some like more chaotic situation going on, because, you know, reality is never that simple. You know, one guy is mastermind and manipulating everything. So I take joy in revealing or like learning about that, but I get fascinated. This is not satisfying you, is it?
Well, do you throw it out, or do you think it's plausible that like how do you think the world is working at the highest levels of, you know, the people pulling the strings? Or is that not something you think about?
What are you trying to get him to admit?
He should watch, I would recommend Hypernormalization by Adam Curtis. Okay. It's a very interesting documentary.
I'll write it down. I think I'm more involved in the entertainment that I get, in the thinking process of like, is it true or is it not true? Like that. I think I tend to consume it as entertainment. So the curiosity is, you know, the need for me to like really get to the bottom of it is not that strong compared to me wanting to know, and then like, ooh, does that mean like there is someone, you know, at the top of this system and he's like this and that? That's really fun. But then I'm comfortable being that ambiguous space.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, so you don't believe anything too wacky. What's the wackiest thing you believe?
That's a good question.
If you just had to give us like one example, like it, judging from yourself, this is the least credible belief that I have.
Mm, that's so hard. I think a lot of journalists. No, that's not true. Oh, I can't say it. I can't say it on air.
What?
I can't say it.
Okay. Oh, you're going to have to so tell curious. Us later.
Oh.
We'll talk about it later. Yeah.
Yeah.
But
I'm curious. I don't want to. I need to know. What have you seen lately besides Social Dilemma that was entertaining to you?
The last thing that's like remarkable was this show on HBO called Watchmen, and it was based on a comic book, and but it's not full of like, you know, action, like superpowers and action. It's very sophisticated human drama using supernatural or superpower elements to it, creating like parallel or like multiple timelines, put them together in a very complicated structure for characters to interact with each other beyond time and space. So it was really, really nice. Chernobyl was really good, again on HBO. I think I like dramatization of historical events. The initial inspiration for Hodobas came from this show called The Newsroom. And it was, yeah, you know, so it's again about a fictional television programs, but it's about off-camera happenings, you know, how they report certain things, but they incorporated actual, you know, news events that happened in the very recent past. You know, Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster was incorporated. Boston Marathon bombing was incorporated within the span of like a year and a half or so. So it was really, it felt really contemporary. And then it was also a really a nice comment on the American, you know, political landscape and where journalism was at that time.
Do you watch stuff just because you're in the industry? Like, do you feel like sometimes you have to watch a certain thing?
Yeah, there are definitely, especially when you're writing something and then something else comes up on a different platform and then that's really similar to what you're writing, then you have to watch it because you can't write the same thing, right? So there are that, and then I think in general people expect you, if you are in the industry, especially if you're a writer, people expect you to watch the latest Star Wars movie or whatever, Harry Potter, or because you people reference, you know, people throw references all the time in the writer's room, and you need to understand them. But other than that, I think what's important for me personally is the ability to really dissect the show and then be able to say why the show needed to be made, like why. All these, like, you know, what about this movie was, like, has been done before and what hasn't been? You know what I mean? Being able to, like, like what's new about the latest show is important.
It might be a weird question, but being in the industry, like, 何だろう? 何て言うの?例えば, こう、プロっぽい好みを持ってないといけない。 っていうか、なんか、なんだろう。これを良かったって言ったらダサいみたいな。とか、これがいいって言ったらイケてるみたいなのが多分一般とちょっとずれてたりもするのかなって思うんだけど、それをなんか意識しないといけない時ってあります。なんか、本当は好きだったけど、本当は結構楽しかったけど、業界的にこれを好き、なんか良かったって言ったらダメな感じがするっていうか、なんか、do you know what I mean?
I think there's definitely unpopular opinions about like big titles, but I don't think people, I don't feel that. I don't feel that pressure. Mm. Obviously when you're working with a big anime studio and then you don't talk shit about whatever they produced in the past.
Right.
But other than that, but I think you need to have a good, like really good understanding of what the mainstream wants. Mm. You can't have just weird taste in movies and shows and create weird stuff and then hope that it sells. It just doesn't sell. So right. You have to understand what each genre requires.
Mm.
Do you find yourself turning down your weirdness? Like you're like trying
down.
To be less weird as you're writing stuff. It's like, oh, this is a little too weird. I'm going to have to tone it back.
I think I start from the bottom. Like I'll try to dial up my weirdness as the process goes on. And then like trying to test the water, you know, am I too much or not, you know? Yeah.
Hmm. Speaking of weirdness, I just watched, I'm Thinking of Ending Things on Netflix. It was pretty weird. It was
I saw the thumbnail. I don't know what it's about.
It was made by the same director of Eternal Sunshine on a Spotless Mind.
Ah, okay. Yeah, I love that movie.
Yeah, I love that movie. So I was like, oh, this is cool. And it was really interesting. It's a kind of a movie that makes you feel super uneasy the whole time.
Mm.
And I like those. But I think this one in particular, I think it's a kind of a movie it's based on a book. And I think that the book must be way better than the movie.
Mm.
Even though I haven't read the book.
What if the book's worse?
I Googled it and it seemed like the book is better. I mean, they made a lot of changes.
Yeah. But the book people always say that.
Yeah,
know,
that's true.
No matter what, if they make a movie of a book I like, I'm going to say the book's better. Because that's in my imagination.
Well, I usually say that, but there are some, like, for example, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. I think they did a great job. Like, the movie was as good as the book. The characters were like spot on. They looked exactly like how I was imagining in my head, which is really rare.
Is the book well written?
Yes. The book was really good. You should read it.
Hmm.
There are three books and it only gets better.
I saw
better.
The movie, I think.
You know what movie was better than the book, the original book? Stand By Me. The original novel was written by Stephen King and it's still a really good story, but there's something about the movie that really captured the precious moments of the age and the being in the in that country in America. Actually, I think I don't want to make enemy, but a lot of Stephen King adaptations are really well made. Let's put it that way. Yeah.
And what about the books?
Books are good, but I think his writing style really I don't think it's for everybody. I love his books, so I enjoy his books a lot, but the audience that the movie, for example, Stand By Me reaches, it's more, the book is more selective as far as the audience is concerned. That's what I mean.
How many books has he written? It's crazy, right?
Thousands.
Like thousands.
Right?
At least thousands.
Thousands. It's crazy. Like libraries just filled with his books.
Like
his extra ones.
Yeah.
How many books could you make from like the stuff he's cut out? It's probably millions.
Oh, yeah. Know? Yeah.
Or does he just not cut stuff out? He just keeps writing more books.
I think he has more. Yeah. I don't know. It's just mind-boggling what he... the amount of work he does, and he like exec produces TV shows and movies too. He's involved in almost all adaptations. So
it's crazy.
Some of those they must be just slapping his name on there.
Yeah, probably.
A couple of those. Right?
Probably.
I've read that he was writing too many books that some publisher was like, please don't like, this is too much. And then he had to publish a book with like someone else's name or something like that.
Oh, wow. What?
Why would they? Would Greenpeace come after
maker.
Him?
For, yeah.
I don't know. Too many trees.
Too much work.
You've killed too many trees making all these books.
Just too much work for the editors. I don't know.
It's just not eco-friendly.
What's your writing process like? Do you have a certain lighting or time of day, or do you wait for a certain mood, or do you just like you force yourself to do it?
I try to establish like my routine, like daily routine. I come to the office, pace around the room, write down, you know, ideas on a notepad. And then there is a moment where you feel like you're ready to start writing a scene. But usually I start with structures, because if you don't have structure, that can get you in trouble later in the process. Mm. Usually with anime productions, we have weekly meetings with the director and producers, and you're supposed to present something. So usually it's the structure first, and then like the more detailed plot, and then with dialogue, first draft, and then second draft. Sometimes you have to present that you're not really completely happy with, but it just, so I work with deadlines. I work well with deadlines and with producers supervising my writing process. Because you got to deliver, you know.
And you do your writing in the office mostly? You're not like at home up until 3 a.m. like writing?
So this is my home office. What you're seeing right now is, I see. And I sleep right next to this office. So
when you say you walk into your office, you mean you walk across the hallway?
I made it sound like I have my own office, but yeah, I walk into the other bedroom.
What time do you wake up? And like, is there something you do as a writer that's different? Like when you wake up in the morning, like, do you immediately drink coffee or something, or there's nothing like special like that?
I sleep a lot. So I sleep like 10 hours a day, and then I take a nap.
Wow.
So I tend to wake up at around 11 or 12 even. And then I stay up until, like 9 or 10, then I go to bed. There's not much, you know, the first thing in the morning kind of thing. There's not, I know some writers have that, and I wish, you know, I hope someday I can discover my own thing. But at this point, what works the best for me is, the, you know, paycheck and deadlines.
Mm. How do you write dialogues? Like, is it almost like acting in your head or?
Yeah. Well, you read it out. In your office, like you read it out, you act it out, and sometimes you cry even, like, or sometimes you yell.
Wow,
that's the whole idea of creating natural dialogue, right?
Yeah.
Oh, can I say one thing about Hotobuzz?
Yeah.
Is that because it sounds like I'm here to advertise Social Dilemma, but that's not.
Are you increasing the Hodo buzz to Social
to balance
Dilemma
it out.
Ratio?
Balance it out.
I mean, not that if people find Hodo buzz entertaining, that's great. But if people don't, then that's fine too. One thing that might be different from traditional J drama, like, you know, how Hodo buzz is different, is that we really tried hard to make the dialogue natural, like sound natural. Because I feel like, and I'm not exactly up to speed with the current state, the latest state of J drama in Japan, because I don't have access to TV, Japanese TV, but somewhat like, I think it's a style of a Japanese, you know, TV drama that the dialogue is very contrived or very, you know, it's overacting. People yell or, you know, cry and then, that's how you create catharsis and stuff like that. We try to avoid that. We try to, you know, make the dialogue lines, you know, as natural as possible. And even in onset, we talk to each actor, and then if there's something weird thing about their lines that kind of trip them over, then we fix that on the spot. So if you are listening to bilingual news hoping that you can learn, you know, to learn Japanese, HodoBuzz might be a good source to really you know, be exposed to natural Japanese dialogue.
Great marketing. Well, I definitely noticed it, because I think that the, like, I don't really watch Japanese TV drama series either, but one thing I noticed is that it's more theatrical, right? It's not really, I don't think they're trying to make it natural, like, at all.
Yeah.
It's more like they're on stage.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, the Western stuff is, it's not theatrical. They're trying to make it as natural as possible.
Yeah. So, I think J-drama exists in its own category. Like, I think it asks the audience to know how to enjoy it. You know, it's sort of like kabuki. You're supposed to have a certain level of understanding of the art itself, because it's not a realistic representation of how Japanese people behave in real life.
Mm.
You know, you don't go like pointing at your bosses or client and be like, you know, baigaishida, or, you know, I'm gonna whatever, you know, it doesn't really happen. But with a story like HodoBuzz, I thought it was really important for the Japanese characters to try to be polite with each other, because that's what we do. And if we want to, and then the big agenda that we've always had as a nation is that we really hate changing the status quo, or you know, like nami o tateru no ga kirai. So it's to really portray how people decide, to really, you know, portray moments when people decide to speak up for themselves, or like stand out despite, you know, peer pressure, or, you know, the damages that might cause to your career. I thought it was really important, because you can watch Japanese TV drama and like be touched or moved, but you can't start behaving like that in your life to combat whatever harassment you face in your workplace. Right.
Yeah, I appreciated that sense of realism in that show. And, you know, there is sort of this, when if you're watching Japanese dramas, it's almost like a live action version of anime or something.
Yeah.
It's kind of
this,
you know, there's something cartoonish about people's, particularly their reactions to things.
Yeah.
I think it is changing a little bit. I mean, I don't watch that much Japanese TV, but I might watch the most out of everyone.
Yeah.
Here.
Definitely.
I think it is changing, but it's definitely not real life. You know, it's not trying to be real life.
Mm.
You know.
I like the natural like representation. Like I like French movies because of that. Like sometimes in I mean, it often happens that, like, women will be changing in front of the camera, and they're not wearing a bra or anything, and, like, their boobs are out, but not in a sexy way or anything, but more in, like, a 普通の kanji, and it's not a big deal. Like, I really appreciate that, because I'm not used to it. なんかそういうリアルっぽい まあでも好みの問題だから多分日本はそういうの好まないか好まないと思ってるかなのかな。
I think it's a combination of, I think it's a little bit of both. The entertainment, you know, what we deliver as entertainment, it really boils down to the business model and leadership, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then the TV stations and also, you know, other types of media like newspaper, Japan is now a really like aged society. Like it's a lot of old people, right? And they need to, as a business model, they need to cater to their existing audience, so they can't stray too far away from what they have been doing. And I think they're could have been moments where they decided to be more bold or to be creative to gain younger audiences, but I don't think they were successful. So I think they've found themselves in a vicious cycle. Mm-hmm. Because if you talk to each and every, like, if you talk to, like, individuals that are working for TV stations they're very, like, well, they know what's going on in the, you know, they watch American TV shows or European TV shows or whatever movies that win awards and stuff like that. They know, but it's the business model and the leadership strategy, you know, how the direction that they decide to go with. You know, I really don't know where or how there could be a drastic change.
Like, there's this issue that always comes up on Twitter about the posters, like how American posters for a certain movie and the Japanese version look totally different.
Yeah.
And I always thought that was like a Western versus Japan thing, but I recently learned that Japan does that to Korean TV shows and movies as well.
Yeah.
So the Korean posters or whatever is closer to the Western style.
Yeah.
It's more like this really stylish, arty, like artsy kind of thing. And then when it comes to Japan, it's suddenly like, if it's about romantic comedy, it's all pink and there's nothing oshare or yeah. anything. And there are a lot of letters and hearts and stars or whatever. なんかそれ、なんかすごい日本は、アジ、なんかアジアと思ってたけど、アジアってわけでもなくて日本はすごい特殊なんだと思って結構衝撃だった。
Yeah, I wonder about that, but I also wonder about the audience. If so the thing about Korean audiences is that they actually go to the movies and they pay money and they, you know, the vocal vocal people online, they are also the direct, you know, clients or customers for that product, right? So then there's a point in the, you know, the marketing firm catering to their needs and what they want to see, right? But if people don't go watch movies, or if there's no if people don't pay for the content, then it doesn't really create momentum for the marketing, you know, minds to change.
Yeah, I'm curious because I actually do see a lot of Japanese K-drama fans really upset about this because the posters sometimes misrepresent the content of the show, and like sometimes the show is not focusing on the romantic aspect at all.
Yeah.
But somehow, like, if the leading actor and actress look good, for example, they try to make it look like it's about romance.
Yeah.
And sometimes for the real fans, that's, you know, that's not what they want. So I don't know how, なんかその意思決定プロセスがどうなってるのかわかんないけど.
Yeah.
すごい不思議. Because it makes all the shows look the same.
Mm-hmm.
So
I don't know what the process is, but there's definitely some gateway into the Japanese market for movies and other content. You know, they all get the same, like, subtitles put on them, and they have their special movie titles and movie covers. But also in the music industry, at least since 2000, a lot of artists would release albums and then they would release a Japan version.
Yeah.
Do you remember that? And so there's kind of this Japan release, like you get extra songs in Japan, you know, so that kind of reminds me of that whole, I don't know if there's still, I don't think we get any extra songs in Japan anymore. They took those away.
Yeah,
and we didn't even notice.
True.
Yeah, that's weird, but that was normal, right?
That was normal. Japan had this special
treatment.
There was special marketing and special songs, like content. They would tell artists, hey, you got to do something special for Japan. because they have money and they're a big market, you know?
Yeah.
So like Tom Cruise would fly over here and do a bunch of stuff, but he's not flying up around Europe or other places promoting like that.
Yeah.
You know, he flies straight to Japan and say, konnichiwa.
Yeah.
And then he'd get out of here.
Yeah.
Do Mission Impossible 7 or whatever.
Yeah, I remember that. Are they still doing that to Japan? They come to Japan?
I think it's online now.
Oh, yeah. You know, well, right now,
like,
yeah.
Hi, Japan. You know, hi, all my fans in Japan. It'll be like, you know, Katy Perry or something. Right?
So long, man. Yeah, weird. I mean, I remember, like, the first Britney Spears album, I bought the Japanese version. So it came with a sleeve, you know?
Oh, yeah.
With a complete different, like, pictures.
It's probably worth $1 million by now. How many people have the Japan version?
And the Japan version looked way better than the American version. So
that's dope.
Yeah.
Now it's probably worth even more than
you still have it?
You know.
No.
Ah.
Unfortunately.
I bet people would pay money for the Japan version. If you're like a diehard Britney fan.
So dumb, man.
I have the Japan versions of like all the Incubus stuff
and
some bands like that.
So what are you working on now?
I'm working on a series that's what am I allowed to say? I don't want to get fired.
What are you supposed to say?
I'm working on an anime series right now. It's an episodic series. That's about it. I'm sorry, guys.
It's fine. Do you know when that's gonna come out or?
Oh, anime takes a long time. I think it'll at least be in the next year. Probably late 2021, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing it's an animated version of a film? Or you can't say anything about
that?
Yeah,
I can't say. there's one movie, anime movie that's available on Netflix. That's called Altered Carbon, Resleeved. It's an animated version of, or a spin-off, anime spin-off of... a live action show on Netflix of the same title. So that's out.
I watched that last night too.
Actually. Oh, you did?
I had really severe uncanny valley from the eyes of the characters. The animation is like really trippy looking. Like,
yeah, it's cel shaded.
It's really, the body movement is so smooth and just, it just looks really different than other animated things that I've seen. There's like it. I was so impressed with like how detailed people's movements are. I don't know how you guys are doing. Is it body tracking or is it just
motion capture? I was also really really impressed, like how realistic it is and how detailed movement were captured. What I was like pleasantly surprised was the acting of the, you know, the facial movements. Cause I remember when we were kids and you play like 3D video games and then they try to like make sad faces or happy face or, you know, and then it was bad all the time. Right.
Yeah. It looks dumb.
Yeah. But now it's like much better. So I was really impressed with that too.
Yeah, that was fun. I haven't seen all of it yet, but I've seen the original Altered Carbon also. So it was interesting to compare, and I wouldn't want to spoil it for people, but you know, there's like a crime syndicate Japan element to the show and a lot of cultural things that are interesting in there too.
Yes,
you know, it's way more tied to Japan than Altered Carbon is, which really isn't, you know.
Right. Yeah. When I got on board, the core concept was already there, but I think the idea was to somewhat do like Japanese stuff that people might even think inappropriate if non-Japanese creators do. Like we put in some like stereotypical Japanese culture shit in there and then got away with it just because we're Japanese. Japanese culture and cyberpunk, cyberpunk are very have long, you know, history of collaborating. Mm. So I hope it, you know, blended well.
It's interesting that it, like, yeah, maybe you couldn't make some of those scenes, or you'd be hesitant to make some of those scenes if you weren't Japanese, because it's such, you're going so deep into, like, you know, Japanese culture.
Yeah. For the same reason, I put, like, in Hodobas, there's a gay character, and then he's not a nice guy. He is actually bad. And I think
he's very likable.
He is,
you know,
good. Cause, I think a lot of people, like straight writers, would hesitate to make gay characters, criminals, you know, because of political correctness. And also, like, especially now in Japan, I think, there's this like vibe in the era that you only have to say positive things about gay, or you only have to portray gay people in a positive light, which is a great progress compared to before. But anyway, I wanted to have more nuanced character, and then because I was gay, I was able to be, you know, bold and like make bold choices about it. It was actually my co-writer Dai's idea. For a long time, that character was not gay, and then something was not working. And then Dai said, you know, what do you say if we make this character gay? And then I was like, that's deep. And then I went back to my office, and then like a month later, like, it actually worked much, much better, because it allowed me to really go into my, you know, vulnerable part, and then it allowed me to really be empathetic, or to see the side of his, trying to, you know, let him say his opinion in a more sincere way.
I think that's just mind blowing, and it's so fascinating to me that. I'm trying not to spoil anything here, but it's
Let's
so fascinating to me that you made that because we, like you said about the political correctness, you know, there is sensitivity about, you know, how you portray people with certain, you know, that might be put in certain categories, and it can be sensitive. And so we kind of discount the possibility that a gay character could, you know, be portrayed negatively or could do something bad in that narrative. And it was very impactful and bold, I think.
Thank you.
I think I told you this after I finished watching it too, but I mean, one thing is political correctness, but it was more, to me, it was more like, it's going to be a spoiler, so if you haven't watched it, just please, like, press forward, like, I don't know, maybe a minute or two, but その misogynistic な男性を描くときにとか misogynistic な男性っていうのを思い浮かべたときに、どうしてもなんかストレートの男性を思い浮かべるから、なんだろう、その思い浮かべるけど、でも多分別に常にそういうわけでもなくて、でもその発想自体がなかったから、なんだろう、 like his character thinks that it's so easy to be a woman, right? Like women gets it easy, and that kind of stuff usually, like from my own experience, comes from straight men. So that was really new to me, and it was surprising.
Yeah, I'm glad that you're saying this, because I think it was a really, it was really important for me, really important decision, because I thought it, that way, you know, having that character gay, that way, it will, I thought it would be clearer that misogyny is taught by, you know, in your environment, right? You don't have to be sexually attracted to women to hate women. You know what I mean? Like, you grow up in an environment that's misogynistic, then you become misogynistic. You grow up in an environment that's homophobic, then gay or not, you or straight or not, you become homophobic, right? So by having him not interested in women sexually, it made it clear that he is, like, his hatred is, it's not coming from, like, oh, I liked you sexually, but it's not, like, you're not rewarding or reciprocating, you know?
Right. Yeah, because, like, the societal pressure on men, like, like, you can't escape it just because you're gay, right?
Yeah, no.
So, you know, that might create the sentiment where, you know, you start hating women, thinking that it's so much easier.
Yeah, it's also like, in and of itself, in our community, you know, gay community, it's a real problem. It's it's a problem that has deep root. Like, misogyny is a problem in the gay community. You know, it's a lot of gay men hate to be called, like, effeminate, right? But why is that? You know what I mean? There is culture and history of gay men looking down on like gay guys that are effeminate, or like people they don't like, you know, drag queens, for example. Like, where does that hate come from? Like, what? That's an issue. Like, you know.
That's very interesting.
Yeah. Reality is messy, and that show has that, you know, realistic vibe, I think, more so for, you know, defying the viewer's expectations, because we see the same archetypes, or we see the same patterns in media, and we develop certain expectations for those patterns, you know.
Yeah.
And that can be a source of boredom too. You know, I wasn't bored watching that episode.
It's interesting because, you know, so, like, what you said about, Nihonjin ga on board dakara, chotto Nihon stereotypical ni igaite mo daijoubu toka, like, writer ga gay dakara, gay no hito ga warui koto suru hanashi mo kakeru toka, sono chimu ni diverse tayosei ga aru koto niyotte, ma chotto bold na hanashi mo kakeru tteiu no wa sugoi omoshiroi desu yo ne.
Yeah, because it's underpinned by real life experience and knowledge, right? There's more security there.
I saw that Academy Award changed the rules, right?
Right. Yeah, I read about it. Yeah.
So no, 何% は何？非白人男性じゃないといけないとか、minority をチームに入れないといけないっていう。I thought that was.
What about Japanese movies or like? How does that?
Well, they talk about minority.
Like, foreign movies?
Yeah, so for foreign movies, it doesn't. Well, like, for example, Japanese movies having majority, like, Japanese people, like, that's fine. They're just talking about, like.
But is that counted as minorities?
Oh, or, I think so. Like, Asian?
Yeah.
I think.
Like, Japanese people, like, a movie with Japanese people in it. They are a minority,
yeah.
In that sense, yeah. Right? So a Japanese movie would qualify, or
for foreign movies, yeah, right?
For
like Parasite, like it's fine, like it's
oh, so I see what you mean.
So Japan can just make a movie, 普通に, and it's kind of meets the standard, I guess.
Yeah, because I think they were talking about white men, because that's the dominant demography currently.
Is it like Minority in the United States or minority like globally? Or wait, it must be in the United States.
Yeah, yeah. because this is the perspective is within the American movie industry, right? Because it's dominated by white men, and they're trying to change that.
Excluding so foreign films, right? I think qualification excludes foreign films.
Oh, it excludes foreign films?
I think so. I mean, otherwise, like, if you go to Norway and you, like, you have only white people, they can't have all sorts of diverse. I don't know.
But even if you were in the States, you couldn't film a movie in Norway with... Like a story about just a Norwegian village, right?
Was it?
You wouldn't win the...
Just the cast. I thought it included also the crew.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like the
crew
it's
not
need
just
to be
the,
diverse too.
Yeah, it's not just the
cast. Quota is not...
Oh.
Like, I'm not sure. I didn't read...
So the cast can be all white men and the crew can be...
Like diverse as
diverse?
Well.
But doesn't that doesn't really help, right?
I have to look at
oh,
the...
we've got minorities in the back helping us make this white movie.
Yeah, that's true. That would be
I think the idea, so I don't know about the actual qualification of this, but I,
It says on-screen representation, themes and narratives. At least one
it's on screen.
At least one
on
of
screen,
the lead
right?
actors or significant supporting actors is from an underrepresented racial or ethnic group.
Ethnic group.
So underrepresented racial or ethnic.
Is Japan?
Group.
Japan's not really
so
under.
So
it
says
is it
Asian, Hispanic, Latino, Black African American, Indigenous, Native American. Da 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 da.
So just not white people.
Guess.
Is that what they're trying to? Is that what they're effectively saying?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So your main
and
your
says,
lead and your supporting.
And it says at least 30% of all actors in secondary and more minor roles are from at least two of the following underrepresented groups: women, racial or ethnic group, LGBTQ. People with cognitive or physical disabilities or who are deaf or hard of hearing. And the last one is main storyline / subject matter. It has to be centered on an underrepresented group.
Hmm. So no matter like how good the movie is, if it doesn't talk about an underrepresented group, it's just not gonna win.
I don't. That's
like
that's
by the
a
rules.
Bit strange, right?
So it won't even be nominated.
Stories about white people are banned from winning,
like
the
like
award.
Mad Men.
Is that about?
Oh, so
what
there
about
are
period
white people?
So there are. So okay. So there are bigger categories. So a film must meet 2 out of 4 of the following standards. And what I just read was the standard A. Standard B is creative leadership and project team. So this is about like leadership positions and department heads. And standard C is industry access and opportunities. Like paid apprenticeship and internship opportunities. So, I mean... You can make, like, Mad Men movie, I guess, with white men and white men only if you cover some other... Like, if you have Asian interns or... I don't know, like...
What?
So you can still...
I thought they had to be in a supporting... It's okay if they're not in a supporting role, as long as you...
So you have to cover...
Hire Asians?
You have to cover 2 out of 4... of the following standards, and the standards, you know, like one is the theme and one is the actors, and then the second one is the leadership, like staff, and you know, so it covers different
I see
positions.
That must be tough for HR.
to keep
casting
to keep track of it, but
yeah.
でもまあ逆に言うとだからなんだろう、yeah. 今白人だから下駄を履かせてもらってるみたいな 状況が続いちゃってるからそれを変えましょうっていうことだと思うけど、そう、いや、this is
seems a, wacky.
This is a new, yeah.
I think they'll keep like making changes to it. I guess it's a starting point for them.
Yeah, なんかベクテルテストとかもねよく言われるけど。
うん。
それも結構大事だと思うし。
So Japanese movies wouldn't.
It's fine because we're Asian. We're underrepresented.
I think more like when I hear minority, I try to think about the world rather than like sort of the U.S. centric view.
Yeah.
But do we have an international or like a global movie awards thing, or do we just let America run everything? As an American, it's weird for me to like, but I'm often annoyed how U.S. centric credibility and like certificates and awards and that sort of thing it tends to be, you know.
I think it's when you watch a lot of Hollywood movies, no? Like, 例えばなんかバロンドールとか他の国もアワードあるからイタリアとかもあるし、so
I hear that those exist, yeah.
yeah,
I guess I
do. Do people?
I'm just saying that. I guess
I feel like it's not. It's way. It's like really tiny compared.
I think the markets are really like massively smaller compared to Hollywood. Maybe that's why people pay more attention to American awards.
Yeah. So underrepresented って言ってるからね。そうだね。うまく言葉にしたというかなんかアメリカでっていうことだから。
Why is the whole world why does not everything but so much come out of Hollywood? Do you think that's changing? Are there other places that are starting to, are people opening studios and stuff and making other movies and TV shows?
Yeah, I mean,
elsewhere,
India is like big. The market is really big. But it's
Bollywood?
Yeah, Bollywood. But Bollywood again is not like, it's not like Hollywood where they spend decades and decades to like to really get people outside of America accustomed to its style, right? Bollywood, I think, is still more contained to its homeland. The indie filmmaking scene is actually it's really expanding because we have, you know, the cameras and like streaming services, all of this. Has become much, much cheaper. Mm-hmm. But as far as like big studios go, Hollywood still is, you know, peerless, I think.
Mm. Toronto has made a lot of animation for a long time, right?
Yeah, animation and also video games. Maybe Montreal might be bigger in video games. But.
Mm.
Mm. Yeah, I remember seeing various cartoons and stuff that were produced in Toronto.
Oh, really?
At least. Or maybe in somewhere in Canada. as a kid. I think they... I don't know. I don't remember what I was watching those on. It must have been cable TV. But, yeah.
How come you speak English?
How come I speak English?
Yeah.
So it's a combination of many factors. I think two big things being my early exposure to English, and I think I was born with like natural curiosity for languages. I was born and raised in Japan. I went to, you know, public schools, but I went to this after-school program called Labo Party. It's an international educational organization that has like many branches all over Japan, has a like 50-year long history. It's just an after-school program where kids get together and, you know, sing songs, play games, or, you know, act in skits and stuff like that in English. So you learn English by playing, you know, storytelling. So I grew up going there, doing, you know, stage acting in English and Japanese. And also I was, oh, and then when I was 11, I participated through Level Party. I participated in a homestay program. I spent one summer in Ohio with an American family. So by then I had a pretty good command of like day-to-day conversation in English. And then, you know, in Japan, you have to study English in middle school and high school and university. And then I moved to New York. It was funny. So my English was pretty okay when I moved to New York. But there were some words that I didn't really use growing up that were somehow really still like confused me a bit when I moved to New York. And the one of the most embarrassing confusions I had, I didn't know, was I would confuse the words forehead with foreskin.
Oh my god.
Oh no.
And I didn't know. I think somehow I used it like interchangeably without really knowing what I was doing. And then the way I found out about it is Ash Wednesday. You know what Ash Wednesday is?
Yeah, I went to a Catholic school.
Yeah, so people put like, you know, ash on the head. So
oh my God.
In New York, so I didn't know about Ash Wednesday either. So I went to New York, and then one day, all of a sudden, people have this like black smudge on their forehead, right? So, wait, but if you think
be
about
careful.
It, like forehead and foreskin, it kind of, it makes sense, forehead and foreskin. Anyway, so I was in the subway. I was on my way to acting school. And then that was my first time seeing Ash Wednesday. And then people were having smudges on their head. And then a lot of people in New York. And then I got to acting school. And then you know how at the beginning of every class, you know, they tend to have a small talk, right? And then the instructor will ask, you know, how was your weekend? You know, what have you seen lately? And I was like, oh, you know, I saw something really interesting in the subway. I've never seen anything like that. So there was this guy standing, you know, in front of me. I was sitting in the subway, and then this guy had really dark smudge on his foreskin.
Oh my God.
And then it was like dead silent in the classroom. And then I went on, and he wasn't the only one. There was this other guy sitting next to me, and then I picked up his foreskin, guys, and then there was a smudge on his foreskin.
Oh,
and then I got off the train, I got on the escalator, and then like foreskin here, smudge, and foreskin here with smudge. I was like, what is going on? And then and then no one told me, like no one called me out on that. It just became awkward. They were like, oh, interesting. And then after class, one of my classmates came up to me and she was like, hey, Tsukasa, which train do you take? I take the E. Like, ah, interesting. And then I was like, maybe she was asking for a friend. But I was like, what? Why was it so awkward? And then I realized, you know, oh, okay, yeah, it's forehead. Wait, foreskin. Is it foreskin? Oh, it's forehead. You know, that was the aha moment. Even
oh
to this
God.
Day, I hesitate to say because my brain somehow made them, like, associate it with each other. They're, like, adjacent in my head.
That's so strange. How did that happen? I'm curious
I <don't know>.
Now.
I mean, it's not forehead maybe, but foreskin is not a word that you use so often.
Right.
Yeah.
Did you ever call foreskin forehead, or that didn't happen? Just
I must just have. I you know, up until that Ash Wednesday, I wasn't aware of my confusion.
Yeah.
Hmm.
It's crazy how that happens. Sometimes you just don't know.
Yeah.
Or you just
And you make one in a million
chance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was so funny.
So be careful.
Yeah. Stuff like that happens. I was at the doctor once and they had taken an x-ray of like my ankle or my knee or something. Yeah. And I was there with my girlfriend at the time, and the doctor is like explaining parts of the skeleton, and he points at this one area and he's like, he's saying, like, he's trying to use words in English. I guess doctors, you know, they learn all the words in English. And he's pointing at this part of like the knee and he's saying vagina. and my girlfriend's like, and I'm like, I have a totally straight face. And he's pointing at this chart and saying vagina. And I just could not bring myself to like correct him or say anything or do anything. Like, you know, I didn't help him.
That's great.
I probably should have.
That's great.
But yeah, he was straight up saying vagina. And it wasn't even close. It was like some tendon or something. I don't even know how that's possible.
Oh, God. That's so funny.
Yeah.
That's so funny.
英語難しいね。
Yeah, the, like in my early years in New York, I struggled with, like, you know how in English, if you say like even simple words or simple sentences that can have sexual connotation, like, you know, oh, let's do it, or whatever, like it can mean many things. And then like I struggle with it. People will be laughing and it just flies over my head.
Yeah, that's what she said.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You can add that to anything. Yeah. It's so ridiculous. And I don't know. It seems like way more of a thing in the States than probably anywhere else.
I think so. I think it was made popular by The Office, the TV show.
I love it.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
しょっちゅう出てきたからね。
But you have a vagina. That's a great story.
Yeah, there's worse. I've made mistakes like that are so bad. I don't even want to say. I met a mayor of a city in Japan, and it was a huge privilege to meet the mayor. And we were talking about sort of economic development and why people might leave Tokyo and move out to Inaka.
Yeah.
And so I was explaining about like how they have all these houses that nobody's in. I accidentally used I always get these mixed up, but I accidentally said akisu instead of akiya. So I was like, akisu ga ippai aru kara. And he was like, and this room of like super erai hito in this city are just like eyes bulging. And unfortunately, my mom was actually there, and she like just quickly just put in like akiya. And but no one was laughing. Like, I started laughing because I thought it was funny. But I was the only one laughing. And I look at my mom and she's not even laughing. So I'm like, Jesus. So it was really hard to recover from what I was trying to say.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that was brutal.
Oh,
I've had nightmares about it. Like, I just wake up, like, sweats. Like, oh, that was rough.
But did it matter to this relationship with all these erai hito? Did it matter to you?
Oh, yeah. So I think that because of what's happening with the bull illness, there will be a lot of people working outside of Tokyo, even if they, you know, have a job that's might have been located there before.
Yeah.
And so I was just sharing my thoughts about that with this mayor. And trying to promote or help them promote what
break-ins.
They were. I mean, they have initiatives to, because people are moving out people have already moved out of the inaka, and now it's just old people, and they're getting older,
right?
And they don't have enough young people, so they have initiatives to try to attract young people back to these areas. Specifically, I should just say I was talking with the mayor of Kakegawa, which is in Shizuoka.
Right.
But all these places have the same challenges right now of trying to attract young people, trying to create jobs for young people in those areas, jobs that young people would want to do. It's like, oh, you can come here and be noka, but, you know, not everyone wants to do that.
Yeah, not noka.
I totally went down in flames with that with that error. So it wasn't that bad. But
is that something that you guys...
It was emotionally tough.
Is that something that you guys consider doing in the near future? Moving out of Tokyo? No.
I don't think I would move out, but I like the idea of like Besso or Airbnb or having an escape out of the city if I need one, sort of thing. But yeah, some people might just prefer to be in one place, but I think it's kind of cool to have somewhere else you can go.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. How do you feel about the future of Earth?
That's a big question.
I think it's gonna be great.
Like the next 3 months.
Next 3 months.
Like, how do you feel?
Earth will be there.
Starting from
there. I don't know. So Canada is like, it has a population of like, what, 36 million? Yeah, 36 million people or something like that. So like massively smaller than Japan, you know, in population. But we still have, I think we have daily new cases like going over 1,000 people for COVID. We are just scaling back our regulations on social gatherings. Like it used to be, because I think we entered stage 3 reopening of the provincial businesses and services like end of July, and then the regulation on social gathering was 50 people for indoors, 100 people for outdoors or something like that. So people started having parties and or like a bit barbecue and stuff like that. But now I think starting this Monday, I'm not really clear, but we're going back to 10 people indoors and 30 outdoors or something like that. And then our reproduction number or rate is hovering over 1. So I don't expect within 3 months, you know, it's going to be massively better. If not, like, if anything, that we might have another, you know, lockdown-ish situation.
What happens?
What about the vaccine?
Sorry. What happens if you break the rule? Like, what happens if you have a 20
like
a
really hefty fine. Yeah. Hefty fine.
I see.
How hefty?
I think it's 10,000 or something. Yeah.
$10,000.
Dollars.
Canadian? Yeah. Canadian dollars?
Yeah.
What's that? Like, how many
dollars?
It's like 100
dollars. Is that like?
Oh, it's 100 like 100 probably a little less. Wait, is it?
Seems like a lot.
Yeah.
That sounds expensive.
Yeah.
Breaking those rules.
Your party has to be to be worth it.
Only super rich people can party now.
Yeah.
Would you take the vaccine?
Luckily...
The Russian one?
not the Russian one, maybe. I don't know. So luckily my work situation is I don't have to leave my home, right? So I'm rather protected. So I might wait a little bit. But it all depends on what the process, you know, where their proper steps were. For approving the vaccination and all that. So I'll keep an eye on that.
How do we know? Couldn't they just tell us, like, it's fine, relax?
Yeah, maybe that's why I want to wait out a little bit.
Can you imagine being the first guy or the first person to get the vaccine?
Yeah.
Or like patient one or zero? You started zero?
I mean, it wouldn't be a patient, right? Oh, I mean, the patient of the vaccine. But I think, I mean, it will be inevitably the frontline workers. And it's really unfortunate they are exposed to like bigger risks like that.
Like Putin's daughter.
How about you guys? What's your prospect about vaccinations?
I'm waiting for you to let me know.
Why? <It's safe. laughs> I said it. I'll wait it out. I'll probably get it at one point. Yeah. It's just so limiting.
Mm. Well, the process has halted, right? After someone...
With AstraZeneca. Yeah. Right. There was like a severe... side effect or something.
Yeah, I wonder how long it's going to take to like for it to come out, and then I mean for it to be effective, like so many people need to get it obviously, so I don't know how long the whole thing is going to take. I wonder.
Is it just me, but like over the microphone, the pop filter, Michael always looks like you're about to say something. So I just pause all the time. I don't know. It's a facial expression you have, maybe.
Just have your mouth open or something.
Yeah.
That is one thing, though. If you can't see the other person's mouth, it's kind of hard to judge.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know?
With masks, too. And yeah.
I do tend to, like, lean in close, even if I'm, like, I'm not saying anything. Yeah. I have nothing to say. I'll just be, like, for no reason.
So what
it's a bad habit.
I noticed that, so I'm on Instagram a lot too, and then I noticed that a lot of American influencers are all flying into New Caledonia. It's okay. So weird. Like, I think New Caledonia no nani? Sono. Either a hotel or the local government or something must be paying a lot of money for all the influencers. But I didn't know that, you know, you can travel now. I mean, if you live in the States, aren't you supposed to be in quarantine? Well, not in quarantine, but like, you know, staying at home.
Guess it depends on the receiving country. So they can't come into Canada. Our border is closed for Americans.
Right. Yeah, it's a small island, right? So, you know, all of these people flying in from America, like that doesn't really sound like a great idea to me, but all the influencers are like posting pictures from the beach.
Are they wearing masks? Like,
no. No. Like they're all going to the same location, and it just seems like a weird like marketing thing to me, but
I went to that park in Shibuya. Is it
Yamashita? Oh, the gentrification part? Miyashita, ne?
Miyashita. So-ka. I went to that park the other day, and it was packed with people. Mm. No masks. People just faded. Just drunk.
Wow.
Packed. I went there... I think it was like Wednesday night or something. I just wanted to have a look. It was just packed with... it just looked crazy. I just couldn't believe it. So there was an escalator that comes out at the top. So me and my girlfriend pop up on the escalator. Nope. And just went around and straight back down the escalator. It just seemed like super dangerous.
Japan is really...
I mean, if you don't...
Really, like, as far as... COVID-19 is concerned, Japan is really a mystery to the rest of the world. You know, when I read the news in the Western media, they usually cite Taiwan and South Korea as successful cases to contain COVID. Mm-hmm. And then Japan is like this enigma of like, despite the lack of, you know, testing or lockdown, but you know, the deaths are still low, new cases are low. What's going on, guys?
Well, it's kind of like the opposite of what Michael just said, but when I go out to take out my son to the park or whatever, like 100% of people that I see are wearing masks. And, you know, that kind of shows that, oh, I'm, and like when I, you know, go to a restaurant or something, like, so I guess it's just like each individual is, like, I think we talked about this on the show, but, you know, there was an interview in the States where, like, you know, the interviewer goes to the beach and everyone's like, it's packed and no one's wearing a mask. And they're just like, you know, when I die, I die. Like, they have this kind of attitude. I don't think that's common here. Like, no one.
There were tons of those guys.
Yeah, like.
Miyashita Cohen. All those guys.
Right.
Like, if I die, if I
but
die.
Like, that's kind of. I mean, maybe in Shibuya, there are young people like that, but I guess that's more on a rare side.
There's like clubs and stuff open. There's people dancing and multi-level clubs in the middle of Shibuya. People are out drinking. People are faded. There's tourists everywhere. Like, tourists are just coming to Japan, drinking outside, like hanging out. Like, I see some, like, if you just walk on the street normally during the day, like, most people are wearing a mask and stuff, but there's major Kansen shenanigans. As far as I can tell.
I guess I don't. I mean, I'm a mom. I don't go out at night. I guess I live in a different reality.
The mom circles are not the problem. They're not the ones transmitting the virus.
Yeah, definitely not. Even at the parks. I mean, I feel pretty safe. People take, you know, keep distance and all the. I mean, kids are not wearing masks because, I mean, they just can't keep them on, but the parents are always wearing masks and, you know.
There's this meme that I saw the other day that I think it's just a screenshot of a tweet. It says, if you can save America from COVID by giving up one state, which state, and say why it's Florida or something like that.
I almost said Florida before you did. I'm so sad I didn't.
That's funny.
Yeah.
How do people like Alaska so much more than Florida? It's crazy.
What?
Alaska's like Canada.
Yeah. Well, no, but yeah. Geographically,
like,
yeah, it's really close. Yeah.
Yeah. It's surprising that it's not Canada, but.
What's
yeah,
this?
It's fine, I
yeah,
guess.
Yeah, I'm ignorant of the history of Alaska. I think they bought it. No, America bought it
for like $80 or something.
Real cheap. Little
I don't remember.
Yeah.
It ended up having all the oil. Best move ever.
Florida.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
I don't know when I can see my parents-in-law. I mean, America needs to get their shit together so that we can visit them. But.
Yeah, that's a serious issue. My family is in Japan. My partner's family is in Europe. So we're really, you know, hoping that this thing will go away sooner than rather later.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, some of the relatives live in Florida, and I don't know, I've seen posts about parties and stuff on Facebook.
You have?
Yeah, and no one was wearing a mask, and everyone was kind of like,
freedom.
Like, no social distancing.
Get that freedom.
It is a thing, though, you debate in your mind, like, should I say something about it, like, how depending on how close you are to the person. Like, when I was video chatting with my mom the other day, and then this friend of hers who I kind of grew up with, like, she, you know, this person is like an uncle to me, and then he popped in the frame, and then he's like not wearing a mask, and he's like, oh yeah, COVID is it's a hoax. you know, like, no one's actually dying. And I wondered if I should say something about it or not. Ended up not saying it. But yeah, I don't know. Not a conversation you should have on social media, but.
You didn't, it's, what would you say if you were going to say something?
Yeah.
Excuse me. 5G is perfectly safe, you know, or whatever it is.
Yeah, I don't know. That's exactly why I didn't say. Like, I didn't know how to start the conversation.
That's kind of scary, though, right? Because if he's spending time with your mom.
Yeah, exactly.
Then, like, hey, can you just be responsible?
Yeah.
What if we're wrong? What if it's if that was a hoax, my head would just explode through the ceiling. Like, I wouldn't even know what to do. I'd be on my knees just like, oh my God. Can you, like, what would it feel like to know something so, you know, so world shaking that, and like, no one will believe you, you know, there's movies like this.
Yeah.
You know,
you're like, the only one who knows.
You're the only one who knows in the whole world. It must feel pretty cool.
Really?
Plus, the virus doesn't exist. That must feel pretty cool, too.
Yeah.
That's true. That's true. Yeah.
That's a huge plus.
I feel so much better.
I'm just going to go out and do whatever I want now.
Yeah.
Come on, man.
Yeah.
Well, let's all stay safe and survive this so that we can see each other in person again in the future.
Yeah, I was actually coming to Japan this spring, I think. That's when we were talking, right?
Yeah.
And then this happened. But I'm glad that you transitioned to remote recording.
Yep.
So that I could participate.
Yeah, this has been actually great for us, right? I mean, before we had to wait for someone. Like, if we want someone on, then we had to wait for this person to come here. But now it doesn't matter. So.
Do you think after, you know, everything settles down, do you think you are going back to the previous recording setup? Or keep on recording remotely, even between the two?
I guess it's up to Michael, because he was the one who was traveling.
I prefer in-person conversations, especially with guests, you know. So when this is all over, we'd love to have you back and talk in person.
Yeah, I guess it's easier to control.
It's just a little more immersive. You can kind of take the conversation deeper and to weirder places without kind of losing track of each other. And
true.
I mean, that's what is natural for people to do, right? Yeah. Is to talk in person. But
yeah, and like,
but it's not like it doesn't work like this.
Also, like, technical issues, or なんか人にかぶせて喋っちゃわないようにタイミングを見ないといけなくて、その結果結構 I guess I'm talking way less than, you know, I would have if this was in person. Like, it's easier, you know. まあ顔が見えるしね、多分そあの生の方が。
Yeah.
So. Yeah, and it's weird not to see Michael in person for such a long time either.
Well, so many people, I think, not just us, but probably Tsukasa as well, like, there are a lot of people that you haven't seen for a certain amount of time.
Yeah.
And there are certain friendships that can withstand that, but there are also certain friendships that can't withstand that.
Yeah.
You know, and so I think a lot of people have probably lost a lot of friendships throughout this this ordeal, you know. Fail to keep in touch with people and whatnot. And there's people that you just, maybe you just see them physically somewhere, you know, because you go to some place, but now you don't go there.
Yeah, like the office, school.
Yeah.
Maybe
Whole Foods or something. I don't know.
Well,
I really want to go to the bathroom. But
yeah,
before
we can
wrap
up
this
up.
Thing, yeah, because I've.
But we've been talking for 3 hours. So.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys. I mean, I didn't have much interesting thing to say.
What?
But before before we wrap up, I just wanted to say so HodoBuzz is available on Amazon, Rakuten TV, DMM, Tsutaya TV, like many platforms. If you live in the US or in the UK, it's on Amazon Prime and it's free with Prime membership. In Japan, it's only available for rental and purchase because we need financial support. Unfortunately, if you're in Japan and cannot, you know, fully understand spoken Japanese, there's no subtitles as of now, but we're working on implementing English subtitles for HodoBuzz in Japan on these platforms. And if you follow HodoBuzz Twitter account, either in Japanese or in English, we'll announce that when it comes.
Yep. Cool. Go check it out, people.
But thank you so much for having me on. It's been really a pleasure. I'm really proud of myself that, you know, I was a long time listener.
Thank you so much for coming. It was so nice to see you like this. ちゃんと動いてるところ. Finally.
Thank you so much. It's really interesting to hear about the inside of, you know, this, the industry of writing and producing like shows and scripts and dialogue, and I think it's really cool what you're doing, and I can't even remember what we talked about for 3 hours, but I'm sure some of it was interesting, so yeah, it was a privilege for us also.
All right.
And I hope you come back sometime. Maybe
yeah,
the
absolutely.
Flesh vehicle. You can bring your flesh vehicle in person. physically meet in a real place.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.